starts now. Now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about the minimum wage and, well, the jobs of the future, the debt debacle, which Congress back in session today. It'll be interesting to see if we get a debt deal done at some point, or if, well, are the Republicans really willing to go to the mat? Are they really the party of scorched earth? Again, you know, you look back to the history, you look to the past. When, remember when our credit rating went in the tank? Thank you, GOP. I'm going to talk about that. Also, the Seattle teachers are opting out of all of this needless for-profit high-stakes testing. We're going to find out why. And also, we're going to talk about guns. Yes, guns. The big plan is supposed to be coming out for the guns. Yes, hide the guns. Save the guns. Oh, the guns. The guns. I saw one story down in Georgia. They're giving away guns, and the ad that they show, and I, you know, again, the mindlessness. They show the ad of, you know, come on down to our gun store, and they're misusing firearms. But you know, hey, reality, don't worry about that. All you have to know is Obama's taking the guns. Obama's coming for him. He himself. I've heard. Doing this program, I get a memo every day from the White House that says, yeah, we're coming for the guns. Obama's going to knock on every door himself. He'll have it cleaned up in no time. No time at all. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The big news today, well, after the lottery was already basically handed over to this Camelot Global Corporation, they had their first real hearing. And I thought about it, going, this is kind of backwards, isn't it? We award a contract, and then we have a hearing? Explain to me, and I go and I listen to the people talk about how we need to reinvent government, you know, how we need to, you know, do things differently and in the procurement process, and, you know, because all the bankers come out. We got a lot of investment bankers. We got a lot of people who come out and say, well, you know, we're going to make things better. We're going to do things differently because I'm from the private sector. And he's right. And the thing that gets me is that the guy's right. The private sector does things much differently than the public sector. Authoritarian, a couple of board of directors, a CEO, make a decision, boom, done. That's it. No questions. Don't care about people. Don't care about workers. Don't care about anything but the bottom line, which is their profit. So when I hear someone who is in government say, well, you know, we need to do things more like the private sector, and that means no oversight. So what we saw today, you know, this kangaroo hearing where, oh, yeah, we're going to hold a hearing and we're going to actually pretend like we're asking probing questions. And Pat Vance did a fantastic job of, and in my view, of pretending to ask tough questions because the deal's done. The ink is dry. The I's are dotted. The T's are crossed. I believe it's almost a done deal. The only way I think it stops is if it stops in the courts. And the courts say, and we'll find out a little bit later if I'm right, but I think the only way it stops is in the courts. But I sat through this hearing today, and I came away with some interesting thoughts, which if you listen to everybody speak, all the representatives or all the senators, all of the different folks from from Camelot Global, from all of the different, you know, government people that Corbett sent. Evidently our lottery is doing a fantastic job. They're doing a great job. In fact, one of the top couple in the nation. Here's the rationale. And it doesn't, this is, and I guess I'm, I'm struggling to grasp how the two come together, how handing off our lottery to a for-profit corporation in the hopes that, you know, maybe this works or maybe it doesn't, or who knows. The rationale was is the needs seniors have over the next 20 years are going to grow. We're going to have more seniors because we've got a bunch of baby boomers who are moving into that next phase of their lives, and they're going to need help. So instead of saying, hey, you know, we need to think about this in a rational way, we need to start thinking about, hey, maybe we need to be increasing taxes on businesses or the very, very wealthy or whatever your solution is, maybe we need to be thinking about that instead of saying, hey, let's gamble. Let's gamble. Because as I found out, we fund our senior programs on vice spending. So cigarette money, the tobacco settlement, and gambling, big money generators for our seniors. And as I listened to the CEO of Camelot, as I listened to her speak, I just kind of, her name was Diane Thompson. She's the chief executive officer of Camelot Global Services, who tells me, tells everybody that they're not in the lottery. They're a sales and marketing company. And that this is, you know, like any other consumer, it's like Twinkies. It's like, you know, it's like bubble gum. But in her numbers, and I'm not sure if she meant to say it. I'm not sure, you know, if it's a secret. I don't know. But she was talking about, you know, where the money goes. And the question that was asked to her was about the profit. And she didn't really get to that, but she did talk about where the money, the proceeds go. Here in Pennsylvania, the proceeds from our lottery go to seniors, go to senior programs. There's a whole number of them. Rebates and tax rebates and stuff like that, all kinds of stuff to go to fund our senior programs. When the CEO of Camelot Global Services, PA, LLC, when she said what the money that in the UK goes for, you know, the $1 billion that we fund our senior programs with here, if they had that money in the UK, it would go to fund art. It would go to fund heritage programs, cultural programs, the Olympic Games. It helped, and they were very proud of the fact that they had given a couple of $1 billion to the Olympic Games, I think it was. And they went through all of this philanthropy that this money goes through. And I sat there, and I'm thinking, there's a real massive cultural difference between the U.S. and the U.K. And it slapped me right in the face because here we are in this country who, you know, we're the good God Christian country, we, you know, family values, yet we're funding programs for our most vulnerable, our most beloved, our mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers and great-grandparents. We're funding things that help them and help to make their final years better off of the whims of gambling, off of our vice. Yet in the UK, they funded that. That's a matter of their priorities. And I guess, you know, I look at this and I go, do we have our priorities screwed up? I mean, when I think about that, they're talking about, well, we need to privatize this because demands, our needs are going to grow. So we're not figuring out how to deal with those problems. We're hoping that some silver bullet privatization scheme, some wish and a hope is going to solve that problem. And I'm telling you, the only way this is going to work in my view, and they laid it out in their plan and they were very specific, and they were, I gotta give the CEO and the president of Camelot, Pennsylvania, a guy named Alex Kovac, I gotta give him credit. They were honest. They said exactly what they were going to do. We're going to, and they used it over and over and over again. Increase participation over and over again. What's that mean? It means more people playing. We need to get more people hooked on our product. We need to get more people gambling. And they tried to say, well, what we need to do is we need to widen the base so more people play in smaller amounts. You know, get away from those, you know, the minority voters, you know, the folks that are the small numbers. Because they said in the UK, and this kind of blew my mind, They said that on a weekly basis, half of the UK plays their lottery. Half. And on an annual basis, they get about 72% of the population buys their products, their scratch off, their internet, their Keno, whatever it is, the gambling products that they offer. They claim 72% on an annual basis, 50% each and every week. Here in Pennsylvania, according to their surveys, this is one of those things that makes you go, this is the guy who's running a big corporation. Your numbers are kind of far off. He said one study said between 10 and 13% of folks here in Pennsylvania play the lottery weekly. And he said, oh, there's another study that says 30%. I'm of the mindset probably somewhere in the 10 to 13% range. Because the vast majority of people that I know don't play. They realized it's a sucker's bet. House wins. Now, here in Pennsylvania, when we talked to, I think it was Dave Philman we talked to last week, who we're going to talk to again tonight, he said that the prizes here in the Commonwealth that go to our lottery, somewhere around 64%. In the UK, it's 50%, according to their testimony. So right there, stop and think about it. If they just follow the business plan that they've done in the UK, you're talking about the prizes, that the payout dropping considerably. Where does that money go? Obviously, it's going to go back to the company. And, of course, the Commonwealth will get a little bit of it. And this is heavily weighted on this idea that we're going to roll out Keno. And when we talk a little bit later, they claim, and you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought in order to pass a new game like Keno, a new vein of gambling, that you'd have to get legislative approval. That, you know, it got shot down back in the 90s badly. So they didn't do it. I thought you had to get legislative approval. They're saying they don't. That the Secretary of Revenue has that ability. We'll talk a little bit later to a former Secretary of Revenue from the state of Pennsylvania to get his take on, can they do it? And if they can, you know, why don't we just do it? Because I think it's pretty clear. I'm a firm believer in if we can do it, let's do it. Why privatize something we can do ourselves? Why profitize something, especially to a foreign corporation? Why do that when we could just do it ourselves? Now, there's the other side of me that says, do we really want to have that expansion of gambling? Do you want to have access in every bar and every computer and every screen in the Commonwealth? Do you? I don't. I think it's a bad idea. I think it's a bad precedent. But here's the other thing that caught my eye. They testified that in the UK, people 16 and older are able to gamble. And if you go back and you remember what I said about a month ago, I said, hey, let's put, you know, like vending machines, let's put the lottery machines and all of the machines, the Keno game and all that stuff in the schools. We could teach them math. You know, kind of like I knew, you know, running numbers, you know, when I was a kid. You know, hey, it's how you learn to do your math. I'm telling you, mark my words, if this contract goes through, they get this, I guarantee you down the road, at some point you're going to see them pushing for a reduction in age. Because, well, you know, they have cell phones now. And, you know, all these kids have disposable income. And I would love to see a breakout in the UK of who it is that's doing the gambling. What age group are we talking about? So a lot of interesting things today we're going to go through here through the first hour. I'm telling you, I think it's a bad idea. I think we're getting screwed. But it looks like it's a done deal. Going to take a quick break right back after this with Dave Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Stick around. After all, something as simple as rock and roll would save us all. Now who'd have thought that after all, it was rock and roll. Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. What's it like to be a freshman in the House of Representatives? Wisconsin's Representative Mark Pocan has spent the last 2 weeks becoming acclimated to life in Washington, D.C. Pocan said one of the priorities of the new Congress should be getting beyond the debt ceiling issue for at least a year, instead of simply kicking the can down the road to be fought over again every 2 months. He said getting past that will help Congress start addressing important issues such as the tax code.
We are going to do a revision of the tax code, and I think that there's a lot of things that we can find agreement on by people from different perspectives just because they're kind of antiquated laws. But we can't if we can't get past some of this other stuff.
Pocan said one issue that could continue gridlock in the Congress is the efforts to make cuts to Social Security.
There's a number of us in Congress who, if you start talking about cuts to Social Security or Medicare, they're going to be non-starters. And it's not trying to do it from a partisan perspective. It's just it's a commitment to people who have paid into these programs and are entitled to the very basic existence that they get from those programs.
While serving in the Wisconsin legislature, Pocan had a reputation for his ability to reach across the aisle and find common ground. He said he's hoping to bring that to Washington.
I think what I've always done before is what I want to do here. You can disagree, but you can do it without being disagreeable. And I'm hoping that, you know, we can have something get done early this session.
He said he thinks the weakness of House Speaker John Boehner and the negative perception constituents have of Congress could actually work in favor of getting business done in the 113th Congress.
Whether it's Paul Krugman or any other major economist who, you know, has a more populist perspective, they're all saying the same thing. So the question is, can we convince Congress to in this current set of negotiations? But, you know, let's remember, we have the president, we have the Senate on the Democratic side. They have the House, but it's a much different margin, and seeing just what he went through in trying to get his Plan B done, he couldn't get votes for his Plan B, maybe there are some opportunities that we can, you know, get some things done with our Democratic minority, but with also maybe some folks who really are very cognizant that Congress is so despised and we need to do something.
Pocan is a member of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which has the United States Postal Service under its purview. He said he's very aware of the facts behind the struggles of the Postal Service and hopes to use his position to address those problems.
It's the only federal agency that has to pre-fund retirement for 75 years. The post office would be a profitable entity if it wasn't for this unusual requirement.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm an innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So I look at this, and to me, the glaring thing, there's a bunch of things that just pop out at me, but one is the cultural thing, this idea that we're going to fund the programs for our most vulnerable, for our most beloved off of our vice. Whereas in the UK, as their CEO pointed out, they fund that as a matter of course. The lotto money goes for philanthropy, goes for art, heritage, and the Olympic Games. Just a different thought. But here to talk a little bit about today's hearing and the privatization scheme, I've got Dave Filmon, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, on behalf of the 200-some lottery employees, management and union folks, I appreciate you showing up today and also keeping this on the front burner on your show and also your website.
I mean, this is important because these people are supposed to be the folks who are going to bring us accountability and transparency and all of those things that they talk about good government. This is, to me, anything but good government.
Yeah, you know, you said it correctly. They couldn't say enough today how well the lottery is being run currently, how well the lottery has been run in the past. All they kept dwelling on is this future issue, which they're trying to load up with these new games, the Keno and this ball of air that Camelot's bringing to the table, which is just this anticipated growth that they're going to try to do without being in Pennsylvania at all. It's just bizarre every way you look at it, and including the fact that so many hundreds of folks are going to lose their jobs.
You know, I look at this, and one of the things that another thing that popped out, because I've, in a very joking manner, said that we should just put lotto machines in the schools. It'll help teach with math, you know, a lot of good things, because we're going to do it anyway. And yet I hear the testimony from the folks from the UK saying that there, 16 is the legal age. So I'm looking at this going, at some point, is it possible we're going to see a push to lower the age to participate in this?
Well, that's what a lot of the private outfits do. You heard the testimony today. They're going to not get more people to gamble more, but to spread the base out larger with smaller bets. Now, what they some of the game plan is, and I think I've said this on your show before, set up shop closer to welfare offices, set up shop close to the cash checking operations, more towards the senior centers, because that's the biggest players, are the lower income folks as well as the seniors. And that's how they have to do it to expand their program. And you were right about the issue of the senior program here in Pennsylvania. You know, we have to fund it. Keep in mind, England has a national health care program too, which our seniors aren't benefiting from because some of that money goes to the prescription help. So it is a whole different ideological, way of looking at things in America and the UK.
Can you talk a little bit to the beginning of the lottery? Because something was mentioned during the testimony that there were only a few core programs that the lottery was supposed to fund, and has expanded beyond what it was supposed to, that used to be budgeted, as I understand, and now this is taken over off of the budget, which I got to be honest, I'm uncomfortable with funding programs for my grandmother and for my grandparents' generation off of vice spending.
And this is a classic example of a government agency that has been very, very successful and it's been its own demise. When the Lottery Act was first passed in 1971, there were about four different core programs that were going to be benefited by the lottery proceeds. They were going to be all senior programs. It was going to be the PACE and PACENET program. It was going to be some transportation subsidies, rent and property tax rebate, and then some money going to senior centers. As the lottery kept growing and growing over the years, the legislature and the subsequent governors took a look at this and said, let's add some, take some of this money off and move it over to DPW with the senior Medicare program or the senior Medicaid program or some of the other programs out of aging that are senior programs. So they're about, they actually doubled the amount of programs that were out there that were being funded by the lottery proceeds. And of course, there were times as we got clue the 2008 and some of the downturns in the economy, but we were still funding those programs, so there were some bumps in the road. But that has straightened itself out, and the lottery, as it was last year, with over $1 billion in net revenues, 8% increase from the year before. The first 6 months of this year is even doing better yet. So now we've got an agency that is funded solely by the lottery. It's not tax money at all. All the proceeds are from the lottery tickets, and it's doing so well. Now we have to think about getting rid of it. And, oh, by the way, lottery guys and gals, you're not going to do the Keno stuff. You have the ability to do it. You're not going to do it. We're only going to give it to a private outfit, and if it's successful, we can give them all the credit.
It's mind-blowing. And I guess the question then becomes is, does the Department of Revenue have the power to say Keno is now something we're going to do? Because I always thought that had to be something that the legislature had to okay. And I understand there was a vote back in the 90s shot down overwhelmingly. Isn't this usurping the power of the legislature?
Exactly. Illinois, and we've talked about this before, they privatized their lottery operation, kept all their employees, by the way. They're all state employees still. It's just the upper levels of the management. So they have a North Star group that's giving them advice as far as running the operation. Keno, and that's the basis for our lawsuit we filed a couple of weeks ago, about a month ago, was that Keno machines are actually in the casinos right now in Pennsylvania. They look exactly like a slot machine, and they have to be approved by the Gaming Control Act, the casino board, for approval, we feel, in the state of Pennsylvania. When Illinois approved Keno, they too voted legislatively to do that. So you're right. Not only the history in Pennsylvania where we voted on it before it got shut down, but also another state that is similar to Pennsylvania also approved Keno. The Department of Revenue, the Secretary of Revenue today danced all around that, saying that's part of the lottery. It's just another game. We totally disagree with that.
You know, I was reading some information put out by the Tea Party think tank over at the Commonwealth Foundation, and they were talking about the state employees, and almost they've got nothing to worry about for a year. Camelot's going to keep everyone for an entire year. I didn't hear that in today's testimony.
Absolutely not. There is no guarantee. They dance around it that they said they're going to have all these vacancies for jobs. They could have gladly come out and said two things. One, we will keep all the employees as they are and at benefits and wages as they are. And two, we'll recognize the union. The only thing they said was, yeah, we have a lot of vacancies and employees you can interview for your own job again, even though you've been doing a hell of a job for the last 42 years. And B, yes, they can unionize because the state law in Pennsylvania permits that. Well, no kidding. We know that. We'd have the ability to do that. So really the employees at this point, based on everything that's being said, are a second thought. They are the ones that brought this lottery to one of the best run in the nation. Camelot advised California, as you saw today, they were talking about it, and in their California advising to their lottery, they quoted Pennsylvania as an example of how you should run your lottery. So here we are. Again, it's an agency that's doing very well, and it's for their own demise, and the employees, we're not sure exactly who's going to be hired, if anybody, and we don't even know when that's going to start.
And they won't all be here in the Commonwealth.
Absolutely. Who knows where they're going to be? Yes, they set up shop in Delaware already, but their whole basis was they wanted to be a global operation. They just picked Delaware. Why? Because they have to pay corporate tax in Delaware. Although they indicated on Friday they filed papers to be in Pennsylvania. So it's quite a shame. And, you know, the bottom line is this. We've got a company that's coming in, taking money off of the system, and sending it over to another country. It's totally bizarre.
You know, two things on the lottery itself. Senator Teplitz asked the question, is this something we want? I mean, do we really want to have access everywhere? Do you want to have it in every screen? Do you want to have it in your home, in every bar or tavern? Do we really want that in our society?
Well, and that's a question I think the more conservative members of both houses are going to take a look at. Actually, in the hearing audience, State Representative Paul Clymer out of Bucks County, who is very against gambling, was there for most of the testimony today. I think that you're going to see some pushback, especially from the conservative Republican legislators, that this is expanding, especially the Keno. That's an expansion of the gambling operation, and it's something which really shouldn't have been there in the first place. Additionally, you know, they danced around this online gaming stuff, which they weren't really specific at all about. But, again, this is the whole promise that Camelot is bringing to the table. They want to bring the Keno in. They want to make sure the minimums are sent to the seniors or stay at the low level of 27% instead of the 30%. And they're cognizant that the minimum payouts, as you said in the beginning, were 40% for prizes. We pay 61% right now for prizes. So that's the first thing they're going to take a look at and start rolling that back. So you look at those areas, and we're talking millions and millions of dollars they start skimming back.
So last line of questioning then. You know, is there, other than the lawsuit, is there any way to stop this? I mean, is the legislature going to be, because it's my understanding, it's a signed deal. It's a done deal. They've crossed the T's, dotted the I's. The ink's already dry, in my view.
Well, it's not. They have come to an agreement. Obviously, that's what they talked about today. There was a press conference later on where they clarified the new Attorney General, Kathleen Kane, who gets sworn in tomorrow afternoon, has to give the blessing to this piece. So those are issues that are still out there. Our lawsuit, and I understand some of the Senate Democrats are going to file a friend of the court piece with that lawsuit, so we'll have a lot more folks involved with that. So we're not done with this yet, Rick.
Because it seems quite odd to me that you signed the bill, you signed it off on Friday. On Monday, you then have it, your first public official hearing somewhere where I could go and get information on it.
Not only that, but they were very evasive on some of the issues, not clear at all. And they add insult to all this injury, what's going on. They sent out an email to the employees on Friday afternoon at 4:45 p.m. They get off work at 4 o'clock, the employees, so they didn't even know the email was going out.
Jeez. Well, again, you know, I look at a lot of the backroom dealing, and I look at a lot of the, and I'll call it what it is, it's shady dealing that this administration has been doing, be it on, you know, the wine and spirit shops, be it on this or any number of things, and I'm uncomfortable, with the way that they're doing things.
It's really a shame. And you talked about that Tea Party Commonwealth Foundation. You know, they sent a piece out. You know, they brag about how they're so patriotic and so American. Now they're promoting a British company to come in and take American jobs away from Pennsylvanians. It stinks.
I'm right there with you. Dave, I appreciate the time. We would love to have you back as this continues down the road.
Keep up the good work, Rick. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Beat up cars, tires and drummers go crack, boom, bam. R-O-C-K in the USA. R-O-C-K in the USA. R-O-C-K in the USA. Yeah, yeah. Back in the USA.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The official theme song of President Barack Obama's three-day inaugural ceremony and celebration should be Little Richard's classic, Slippin' and a-Slidin', Peepin' and a-Hidin'. A month ago, Obama himself put his inaugural committee on the slippery slope of ethical compromise by choosing to accept cash donations from corporations to pay for the festivities, which are estimated to cost in the neighborhood of $40 million. This decision went against his own principled stand just 4 years ago to reject money from these special interests. Acknowledging that his ethical backflip this year looks bad, he's tried to soften the impact by declaring that, one, his lawyers would vet every corporate check to make sure it does not pose a conflict of interest, and two, that every donation would be promptly posted on the inaugural committee's website for all to see. But as he slid behind this pledge of transparency, he slipped on his own legalistic cleverness. Go to the website, www.2013pic.org, and sure enough, you'll find a long list of names. But that's it. No indication of whether they're corporate executives, no clue as to what city or state they're from, and no revelation of how much money they've chipped in. This isn't transparency, it's trickery. Only six corporate names appear, including AT&T, Microsoft, and Swiss-owned biotech giant Genentech. Excuse me, but all three of these have truckloads of favors they want from the White House. They reek of conflicts of interest. Again, there's no disclosure of how much cash each one put up. But news stories have revealed that the Obamacans are asking some donors for as much as $1 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, who do they think they're fooling? Besides themselves. This isn't slick. It's clownishly inept. And it's ethically shameful.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Yeah, another thing up on the chopping block. And, you know, to me, again, you know, you look at this, and if it were a good idea, I think we would have that open transparency and have that discussion in public. Just the way that they've gone about this. And maybe this is the greatest deal in the history of deals. Maybe this, as the one guy said when I forget which senator it was, said, hey, well, looks like you guys at Camelot won the lottery. And the guy turned around and said, no, seniors in Pennsylvania won the lottery. Even if that were true, don't you think if that were the case, that our governor would be rolling this out in grand fashion? Look what I have done. Not signing something at, 4:30 on a Friday after everybody's gone, the news cycle's... I mean, it stinks to me. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not someone who plays the lottery. I'm honestly probably the only person I know who has never bought a ticket and probably never will. And one of the reasons why is, you listen to the testimony by the people at Camelot today. And they talked about how when they first started the lottery in the UK, because they were the private vendor there, I guess, 18 years ago when it started. When it first started, everybody was on board. I think they claimed they had like 92% participation. And then, of course, people realize I'm losing and I'm losing a lot. And they stop. So they have what's called fall off. So what they were talking about, and this is a part of their marketing plan. I'm uncomfortable with gambling as a consumer good to begin with. The vice idea, I'm kind of uncomfortable with. But if you're going to have it, you want to do it, fine. I just don't think it should be saturating our society, which is what they really are going to do with this. It is going to be everywhere. And the question then comes up if, how much money is available out there? I mean, you think about what available disposable income is out there. How much gambling money is out there? They keep talking about increasing participation, and I'm thinking, the same people who are doing it are probably going to continue to do it, and maybe you get a small number of people, because it is a little more convenient, who are going to chime in. But the vast majority of people, they're already gambling what they're gambling if they're going to do it. But they're doing it on the ponies, or they're doing it on the slots, or they're doing it at the table games at the casinos. How much more is left over? And I don't think there's an awful lot. And I think, as I said from the beginning, they are going to change the awards. I think Dave said it was 61% of the money that of every dollar is returned in prize money. The things that you can win in the UK, they testified today, 50%. So right there is 11% of what a $3.5 billion pie. 11% of that going somewhere else. That's an interesting, the way they're going to jockey with this to make their target goals, creative accounting, I'm sorry, I'm not buying. I think it's a bad idea. And you look at all the accounting scandals we've had over the last several years and how you cook the books, bad idea in my view. And this, and I guess the fact that what gnaws at me is that after the deal's been inked, then you have your first hearing. And it was kind of the Republicans, some of them, okay. I'm uncomfortable with it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk with former Revenue Secretary Tom Wolf, going to be here. Also, hopefully get him to be a gubernatorial candidate, because he wouldn't pull this kind of nonsense. We're going to talk to him when we get back.
Ocean of Red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you have experienced any of the following symptoms: crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Earth. Sky.
We live in an island of stars called the Milky Way, and many know that our Milky Way is a spiral galaxy.
In fact, it's a barred spiral galaxy, which means that our galaxy probably has just two major spiral arms, plus a central bar that astronomers are only now beginning to understand. But where within this vast and intricate spiral structure do our Sun and its planets reside?
Our galaxy is about 100,000 light-years wide, and we're about 25,000 light-years from the center of the galaxy. It turns out we're not located in one of the Milky Way's two major spiral arms. Instead, we're located in a minor arm of the galaxy. Our local spiral arm is sometimes called Orion Arm.
Our local Orion Arm of the Milky Way is about 3,500 light-years across and is approximately 10,000 light-years long. Our Sun, the Earth, and all the other planets in our solar system reside within this Orion Arm. We're located close to the inner rim of this spiral arm, about halfway along its length.
The Orion Arm is named for the constellation Orion the Hunter, which is one of the most prominent constellations of Northern Hemisphere winter or Southern Hemisphere summer. That's why we see so many bright objects within the constellation Orion, because when we look at it, we're looking at our own local spiral arm. We have a picture of this at earthsky.org. Search for the words Orion Arm. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And he's absolutely right. Had this happened during the Rendell years like this, where you sign the deal on a Friday and then, well, we'll have the weekend to let the ink dry and then we'll have our first hearing. I think not only the Republicans would have gone nuts, but I think Democrats would have too, because this is just, this is the wrong way to govern. This is, well, just flat. There's no transparency here, no oversight, no accountability, not in my view. Which is why I have asked former Revenue Secretary Tom Wolf and hopefully potential gubernatorial candidate this next time around to come talk to us. Tom, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure. Nice to be here, Rick. Thank you.
You know, I sat in and listened to the hearing today. I don't know if you saw it, but I sat and listened to the Corbett administration say that they're perfectly able to let Keno go through. So my first question is, former Revenue Secretary, do you believe that's accurate? Did you have the ability to push Keno through?
Well, I think the governor's office probably does have the ability to push Keno through, but that was never the question, at least when I was in the cabinet. The question was whether that made any sense or not, and the thought was it did not. And one of the big reasons was that it would eat into a lot of the business that the casinos were doing, and the casinos were providing a lot of tax revenue for Pennsylvania. So one of the issues here, if I can back up just a little bit, in addition to the governance issues that you raised, is why are we doing this? The Pennsylvania State Lottery, at least when I was there, and I'm pretty sure right now, is a very well-run organization. And the only thing the only way you could actually increase revenues is to add games like Keno. That have all kinds of implications for other sources of revenue for the Commonwealth. So I'm not sure this is in anybody's interest to do this. I'm not sure it's necessary, and I think, like you, it's the wrong thing to do.
Well, Camelot was quite honest about it, and you have to give them credit. They were honest. They said, look, we're going to increase participation. We want more people to play. And in the UK, where it's ages 16 and above, then it begs the question, are we going to, at some point down the road, be being asked to let 16-year-olds gamble?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things that I think we get from having the lottery serve as a public institution is that you have transparency and you have democratic oversight, democratic with a small D, I mean. The idea is not that you want to necessarily have everybody play. In fact, you can't play if you're under 18 in Pennsylvania. At least you couldn't when I was Secretary of Revenue. The idea is that if you're going to gamble, if you're going to have something like a lump lottery, that it ought to be run in a responsible fashion. And that was the reason I think it was done in the first place, the reason it was made a public institution. And I'm concerned that and especially the way Camelot is talking about increasing the participation rate, I'm concerned that some of the restraint that we purposely put into the lottery as a public institution will be taken away, and that it will, as a result, be weakened.
Yeah, well, to use the folks from Camelot's numbers, they say currently Pennsylvania lottery users, customers, about 10 to 13% of the population of the Commonwealth purchase these games on a weekly basis, whereas in the UK, 50% of the population purchase these games. So obviously their goal is to take that 10 to 13% number up to where it is in the UK, up to 50%. And I guess the question is one, is that good for our society? Is that really what we want to be doing? And two, as you pointed out, is it going to harm all of the other things that we've allowed to prop up?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the two questions are good. Is it good for society? I think, again, one of the things that the public ownership of an organization like the lottery does is allows the public to control its expansion. For example, in the old days, you'd never see, and I think it's still the case, you'd never see a lottery ad showing people on the beach saying, "Thank you, Pennsylvania Lottery." The idea was not to encourage gambling. It was to say if people are going to play a game, if people are going to think about what might happen if they win the lottery, in the unlikely event they win the lottery, that they're doing this on their own. They're no false promises. I think that's what you get in a public lottery. If you want to extend that, if you want to just sort of show this as something that is more than it really is, you probably could increase the revenues from the lottery. And certainly, to your second question, if you want to expand the number of games, you could also improve the revenues for the lottery. But again, at what cost? What yeah. social cost and what economic cost to the other actors in that part of the economy?
Yeah, one of the folks who testified, Executive Deputy Secretary Pete Tartline, said that, it was a sweetheart deal for Pennsylvania. So let me ask you, as a business person, would you enter into something that was a sweetheart deal for the Commonwealth, given this current agreement? I mean, because the way I'm looking at this, the only way that Camelot makes money is to raise those numbers up or to cheat people on the payouts, which, as they've pointed out, their payouts are about half of the revenue that they bring in. As we're here in Pennsylvania, it's 61%.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've been in business all my life except for the 2 years I was in the cabinet. I can't conceive of how someone can say, I'm going to promise you $34+ billion of net profit over the next 20 years. I can't promise what my sales are going to be tomorrow. So that concerns me. There are some guarantees. I guess there's a $50 million collateral in the deal that I've read about, if that's right, or $150 million cash collateral on about a $50 million line of credit, letter of credit.
Right.
I'm not sure how $200 million parked anywhere gives the Commonwealth any certainty that this company or any company is going to be able to deliver on a $34 billion promise.
Because my big concern here, Tom, is that 3 years down the line, when Camelot can just opt out, what happens if they decide we're just not going to do it? Where does that leave the Commonwealth?
I don't know, and I'm struggling to understand why this makes any sense. I mean, again, there are two things that might be driving this. One is the general ideological belief that a private sector solution is always superior to a public sector solution. Again, I've been in the private sector all my life. For the 2 years I was at Revenue, and when I was and overall charge of the lottery, I was really impressed with the caliber of the people at lottery. And I'm not sure that I've been in any organization that has had a superior caliber of people working for them. So I'm not sure how. I mean, there are people who are incompetent working in the private sector, and there are people who are very competent working in the public sector. That generalizations don't really make any sense. The second thing is, if this kind of a deal brings maybe an acceleration of cash flow to help in the short term for whatever political reason, that might be a political reason to.
Yeah, but I don't see that.
Well, and I don't know exactly what is driving this.
Because I think you're right. I think it's pure ideology. It's, you know, let's sell off everything we can. Because I look at the wine and spirit shops when they wanted to auction those off to the cheapest bidder. Originally, they came out with $2 billion as the big number. We're going to sell it off for $2 billion. And quickly, that was set aside. Well, maybe not that. Then it was down to 1.7, then down to 1. And then it just became, well, we don't know how much we'll get. It's just something government shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, in this case, with the social issues that I think you want to, for example, I would go to meetings of organizations dedicated to controlling gambling addiction, and some of the revenues that came in from lottery sales went to support organizations that did that kind of thing. Will that continue to take place? Again, the ads that we ran never showed people in situations saying, geez, you know, this is such a wonderful thing that I can sit on this beach because of the Pennsylvania lottery.
Right.
I think there is something more than just profits and revenues that the state wants out of a good lottery program. And I think the controls, the transparency that was forced on the lottery because it was a public institution is something that was really, really important. And by the way, it generated around $1 billion a year net profit. And from what I read, since I've been out over the last couple of years, it's continued to do very, very well. And I imagine this year it's going to have a wonderful year with the way the Powerball a few weeks ago went into the stratosphere.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this is where the big point is for me. I look at, and I guess the big question is you know, as I listen to the testimony of the CEO of Camelot talk about where the money went. She said in the UK it funds cultural programs, heritage, the arts, a portion of the Olympic Games. And then you come here to Pennsylvania where it is funding vital programs for our seniors. And I guess there's just, a huge cultural difference in saying that, you know, we're going to use vice spending to take care of our most vulnerable and our most beloved, whereas on the other side you could make the argument it's just for something different.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not clear on what the intention is in terms of the use of the funds. But right now, you're right, in Pennsylvania, everything goes to support programs for senior Pennsylvanians.
Because I've always been against the idea of using the lottery for senior programs or for education, solely and basing our education spending or our senior spending on what the lottery brings in. Because you know, as they've said, it fluctuates.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should have dedicated spending for that.
That's an excellent point, and I wasn't around during the Schaff administration when the lottery was first instituted, but it has become something that I think seniors and senior programs have come to depend on.
So just a bad deal, you think?
I don't get it. I don't understand why the governor is doing it. And again, as someone who saw the lottery firsthand for a couple of years during the Rendell administration, it seemed to work very, very well. Wish my business worked as well as that one did when I was there.
So last line of questioning, 2014, just around the corner. Where are you coming out on this?
I'd love to do it. 4 years ago, I was being ready to go into the race and in fact, was ready to announce. And I had put everything, everything we owned into a blind trust, so I didn't know what was going on in my old company. But I got a phone call at the last minute saying, things aren't really looking too good. You need to come back. So I dropped the race and went back and have spent the last 4 years trying to resurrect the business. And it's going very, very well now.
Good.
And,
that's good to
so
hear.
I've had the luxury of thinking about maybe doing something that I really wanted to do four years ago. So I would love to find a way to do it.
So this kind of chicanery, this kind of backroom deal never happened under a Wolf administration.
That's absolutely right.
Because honestly, I mean, this, you got to look at this and go, this, there's just something shady about this.
Well, I think one of the things I'm concerned about is the overall state of democracy in Pennsylvania. I think we can do so much better than we're doing. And you're right. This is one example of crony capitalism at its absolute worst. And we are capable of much, much better than that.
Because the reality is we have spent, you know, here on the program, we've spent almost a whole week on this now. We should be talking about job programs. We should, instead of talking about getting rid of 230 state workers, and hopefully, who knows, maybe they end up in Delaware, who knows where, when Camelot takes over. We should be talking about, we need a transportation bill desperately, yet I've still seen nothing on it.
No, you're right. We need to focus on what state government can do best. Education, infrastructure, clean air, clean water, the good things that a good functioning state government can provide its citizens. We should not be doing things like this.
Healthcare exchange. Yeah, exactly. But I got to be honest, I'm glad this governor is not touching the healthcare exchange. I'd be happy to take my chances with the federal program. Tom Wolf, I appreciate the thoughts, the input. I appreciate the expertise. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Tom Wolf, former Pennsylvania Secretary of Revenue, and hopefully at some point he's going to throw his hat in for the gubernatorial race. I'm looking forward to that. But, yeah, here's the thing. And again, you go back to this whole good governance thing. And I'm a big, as said for years, I believe in openness. I believe in transparency. Look, had he come out and said, we're going to hold these hearings. We're going to have public input. We're going to do all of these things. We're going to put it all out on the table. And at the end of the day, when it's all out on the table, if we decide that, you know what, fine, we're going to let this private for-profit corporation take over our lottery that's supposed to fund programs for our seniors, profits are going to go out of the country, probably out of the state, because they were kind of squirrely on, well, you know, we did incorporate in Pennsylvania, but originally in Delaware. And then you start going, whoa, 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 whoa. You mean you're going to take the dollars that people are spending on the Pennsylvania lottery and then wash the profits through the Delaware loophole? Haven't really gotten, there's a statement on it, but here again, I don't know that there's anything in writing. I mean, you could testify, yeah, our intention is potentially to keep those jobs in Pennsylvania, and yes, potentially to keep the profits here. I understand there's some language that 80% of the work has to stay in Pennsylvania. You go, well, I wonder what that is. I'd like to see the language on that a little more. But where do those other 20% go now? Because right now you got 100% done right here. Can we afford in this economy to lose 20% of those employees and that revenue coming into the state? And then what were the conditions of the? I mean, there's so many questions here not answered. So it was a couple-hour hearing this afternoon. That was it. And that's supposed to be okay. Honestly, folks, outrage. Outrage. Call representatives. Say, hey, wait a minute. Where's the outrage in this? But for me, the outrage, I think, is that we're funding those programs with vice spending. And I guess maybe I'm the only one who's hung up on that. But I think it's important. And I guess it shows a cultural difference. Just a thought. If you've missed any portion of the first hour of the program, and I suggest if you did, go back and listen to it. There's a lot of stuff in here about in this first hour about this lottery scheme, which I think is just a dead ripoff. TheRickSmithShow.com or Stitcher on your smartphone. Quick break. Back with hour two. You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
What's it like to be a freshman in the House of Representatives? Wisconsin's Representative Mark Pocan has spent the last 2 weeks becoming acclimated to life in Washington, D.C. Pocan said one of the priorities of the new Congress should be getting beyond the debt ceiling issue for at least a year, instead of simply kicking the can down the road to be fought over again every 2 months. He said getting past that will help Congress start addressing important issues such as the tax code.
We are going to do a revision of the tax code, and I think that there's a lot of things that we can find agreement on by people from different perspectives just because they're kind of antiquated laws. But we can't if we can't get past some of this other stuff.
Pocan said one issue that could continue gridlock in the Congress is the efforts to make cuts to Social Security.
There's a number of us in Congress who, if you start talking about cuts to Social Security or Medicare, they're going to be non-starters. And it's not trying to do it from a partisan perspective. It's just it's a commitment to people who have paid into these programs and are entitled to the very basic existence that they get from those programs.
While serving in the Wisconsin legislature, Pocan had a reputation for his ability to reach across the aisle and find common ground. He said he's hoping to bring that to Washington.
I think what I've always done before is what I want to do here. You can disagree, but you can do it without being disagreeable. And I'm hoping that we can have something get done early this session.
He said he thinks the weakness of House Speaker John Boehner and the negative perception constituents have of Congress could actually work in favor of getting business done in the 113th Congress.
Whether it's Paul Krugman or any other major economist who has a more populist perspective, they're all saying the same thing. So the question is, can we convince Congress to end this current set of negotiations? But, let's remember, we have the president, we have the Senate on the Democratic side. They have the House, but it's a much different margin, and seeing just what he went through in trying to get his Plan B done, he couldn't even get votes for his Plan B, maybe there are some opportunities that we can, get some things done with our Democratic minority, but with also maybe some folks who really are very cognizant that Congress is so despised and we need to do something.
Pocan is a member of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which has the United States Postal Service under its purview. He said he's very aware of the facts behind the struggles of the Postal Service and hopes to use his position to address those problems.
It's the only federal agency that has to pre-fund retirement for 75 years. The post office would be a profitable entity if it wasn't for this unusual requirement.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come tumbling down. The walls come tumbling, crumbling. The walls.
All right, over the past couple of decades, we've seen the gulf between those who are at the very top and those at the very bottom expanding wildly. And I look at the folks at the Carlisle Sentinel, the editorial board, on the prospect of raising the minimum wage. So, that low-wage workers can actually have some dignity and a little respect, that whole work hard, play by the rules thing that the right loves to throw at us. Well, the Sentinel editorial board writes, right now, job creation is more important than consumer spending or addressing income inequality. According to them, in this economy, jobs are everything. And while I agree jobs are everything, so is consumer spending, because if nobody's spending, nobody's buying stuff, and there are no jobs. And if we're talking about income inequality, well, we've got problems. And I've been seeing a lot of reports lately about, all of this stuff is caused by mechanizations. We've got machines doing things that workers used to do. So it's not policy. We can't do anything. It's just how it is. And here to help us work through if this is actually how it is, I've asked Heidi Shierholz, economist over at the Economic Policy Institute, EPI, to come talk to us. Heidi, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
So I've heard this, this talk, we can't concentrate on consumer spending or income inequality. It's all about jobs. But most of the jobs seem to be either going overseas or being mechanized.
Yeah, I like that phrase. We can't focus on consumer spending. We have to focus on jobs. You said it. The relationship between those two things is really tight. One of the reasons that we aren't seeing the job creation is because we're just not seeing demand for goods and services pick up in a way that would mean employers would need to hire.
Yep.
So that's the real you're absolutely right about that really, really tight link between those two things. And then I think one of the key things that you also underscored is we gotta I actually agree that priority number one right now is getting jobs back, getting the unemployment rate down. But even if we got back to 2007 levels of, you know, on the unemployment rate, when we had an unemployment rate of 4.6%, it's not like things were really rosy at that point. We had just, you know, before the Great Recession hit, we were coming off of 3 decades of massively increasing inequality. And so it's just getting back to where we were before the Great Recession hit. That's not going to cut it. That kind of status, that kind of situation is, you know, we cannot go for another 3 decades of stagnant wages and incomes for most of the country.
Well, I mean, the thing is what we keep hearing from the right, and a lot of it is the fact that we have computers, women in the workforce, they claim, everything except the fact that workers have lost the ability to bargain for wages, hours, and conditions, and we have seen a weakened labor movement because business has taken advantage of our broken labor laws.
Yeah, you got it. I'm an economist, and I'm going to diseconomist right now, we have seen this massive increase in wage inequality, and economists like to look at that and say, okay, let's try to figure out why. But economists tend to want to come up with reasons about why we've seen massively increasing wage inequality. They want to come up with reasons that have nothing to do with policy, that have nothing to do with power. They want it to be explained by natural forces, things like changes in technology that led to demand for different types of workers, and that's why we've seen this massively increasing inequality. I have this big, very technical report that we just are releasing now that looks at some of these issues, in particular this technology explanation of wage inequality that we're seeing all the time, that the claim is the reason we've seen this big rising wage inequality is because technology has changed. It's led to different demand for different kinds of workers that have led to this big increase in wage inequality. But here's the piece that gets missed. We have had changes in technology since time immemorial.
Yep.
That we have always had increases in technology that made us more productive, that created different demand for different types of worker. I mean, you think of industrialization and then changes in, that brought, different kinds of technology into the home, into the workplace that have happened for this entire century, last century. The thing about wage inequality is that it started taking off like crazy in the 70s. So if you want to say technology caused that, you have to come up with some theory about what changed with technology in the 70s that meant, okay, in the 50s and 60s, somehow these improving technologies didn't cause wage inequality. In fact, we had broadly shared prosperity. But then since the 70s, all of a sudden, the nature of technology has changed so that now it causes inequality. And that just doesn't actually hold a lot of water. You know, technology has always been improving. We've always seen increases. What has changed is since the 70s, we have, instead of seeing shared growth, we've seen the growth go to the top of the income distribution.
Yep.
You can point to deliberate economic policies that created that have to do with power, and you named a big one, the declining ability of workers who want to join a union to be able to do so because of things like anti-union drives.
Yeah, and the decoupling of wage increases with productivity increases. Once that began, we can work as hard as we want, and this whole idea of a meritocracy where the harder you work, the more you make, doesn't seem to be happening, because I know a lot of people who are working their behinds off, and they're still falling behind.
Yeah, right. And you can actually point to very clear policy choices, deliberate policy choices that were made that actually led to that decoupling. You know, it wasn't some natural forces. It was people making choices about the kind of economic model that we have in this country. We made choices that changed that model so that the the growth of the country went to the top of the distribution. You can point to things like declining real value of the minimum wage, deunionization, deregulation, a Federal Reserve Board that prioritizes stability over full employment. And full employment helps low and moderate income people a lot more than it helps people at the top. Quote unquote free trade deals, globalization that exposes our low and moderate income workers to extremely low pay. Yeah, exactly. The whole gamut of policy choices that were made since the 70s that have just made it so the growth of the country really does sort of just get funneled up to the top.
Yeah, the whole neoliberal cocktail, if you will.
You got it. That's right. It's not natural forces. It didn't have to happen like this. In some ways, when I talk about this and I make that big list, it can feel overwhelming, but I also like to think of it as you could sort of flip that overwhelm on its head and think it's actually sort of has an optimistic overtone to it, because there's so many levers that were pulled to send the money to the top, that there's lots of sort of fronts that we can go at it with. There's the minimum wage. There's card check. There's making smarter trade deals. There's the whole list of things that are sort of fronts to help reverse the processes that led to such rising inequality. So it wasn't one thing. There were a whole host of policy changes that led to this. But that means there's many places that we can fight against it to try to reverse some of that.
Yeah, and there's plenty of opportunity to go back and undo a lot of that stuff. Because
right.
I look at the fast food jobs and the low wage sector right now. I look at that as an opportunity to make those jobs, the next generation of middle class jobs, much like my grandparents' generation, they took truck driving jobs and factory jobs and textile jobs and made those actually living wage jobs.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's right. We have to think about ways to, I mean, one of the sort of threads throughout this discussion is, it's not about workers not having the right skills. It's not about people not having the right education. What we need to do is make sure that we get bargaining power to workers across all education categories. And this is that's the kind of thing, making sure we can, figure out how to organize people in these, sort of typically not, ripe grounds for organization, fast food restaurants, those sorts of things. That should be the new frontier.
Yeah, not to take too many shots at your economist friends, but the reality is if the models that they're throwing out, there's the TINA argument, there's no alternative. The mechanization is going to happen. We can't change it. There's no hope. And I guess the question I then ask is, what does our society look like if that's the case? If there's no hope. We're going to have definitely a two-class system, as John Edwards so aptly talked about, the two Americas, the people living in their gated communities, and then the rest of us, pillaging for crumbs. Is that what we're headed towards?
It does seem to. I don't know if those folks have thought it through all the way, but that is where what has happened over the last 30 years. Unless something changes to reverse that course, we will continue on that trend. So it is an, I think, underappreciated, sort of unmitigated economic disaster that it is heading in this really bad direction that we do need to get serious about undoing. And that it is a tricky, I mean, right now it's hard, it is hard to think about attacking all those fronts when we have unemployment near 8%. Like, first priority number one right now, the thing that will help low and moderate income workers the most is actually getting the unemployment rate down.
Heidi, oh no, the wonderful brain trust over at the Carlisle Sentinel editorial board said that'll cost us jobs. They were told by somebody who knew somebody who might know something that it was going to cost jobs, and we know it and we believe them.
wait, say what? What was going to cost jobs?
Raising the minimum wage. It would destroy hundreds of thousands. It would be the end of job creation as we know it.
That logic is so on its head. So it's funny. Right now would actually be a perfect time to raise the minimum wage, because, you know, there's the consensus amongst economists now is that even those who believe that raising the minimum wage causes some disemployment of lower wage workers, the consensus is that it is extremely small. If my read of literature is that the effect of raising the minimum wage on employment is actually on the employment of low wage workers is actually zero. That the best research, the most rigorous research out there just shows there's really no effect of raising the minimum wage on employment of the workers that are most affected. But here's the thing. It can actually have a positive overall effect on employment. And it's the stimulus idea. It's you're getting money into the hands of very low-wage workers. Those are the folks who are very likely to be working paycheck to paycheck to have no choice but to spend whatever additional, you know, raise they get through raising the minimum wage. They'll spend it in their local economy. That raises demand for goods and services. Who provide goods and services? More workers. So yeah. Employers have to hire to meet that demand.
I agree with you, but my right-wing friends will say, Heidi, that's why we have tax cuts.
You know what? Right now, actually, I mean, the long-run situation aside, that's exactly right. That's why, you know, that is why I'm upset the payroll tax holiday went away at a time like this when what we need to be doing is boosting the economy. It's the exact same logic.
Oh, no, you don't have to do one or the other. Not for those people, for our millionaires and billionaires, because they're the job creators.
Yeah, you know what's wrong with that is there's really solid evidence. What you want to do, if you're gonna cut taxes to stimulate the economy, regardless of who you think should be paying taxes, morality aside, if you're just trying to stimulate the economy, what you want to do is cut taxes on people whose behavior is likely to change if they have more money in their pocket. So you cut taxes on the very wealthy. It's not going to change how much they buy. They're already buying everything they want. They already have all the goods they want. You cut their taxes a little bit. It's not going to change their behavior. So it won't have very much of an effect on the economy. It will just reduce revenues. If you cut taxes on low and moderate income people, the ones who are more likely to be living paycheck to paycheck, them getting a little bit more money in their pocket through, say, a payroll tax holiday actually means it will change their behavior. They will spend more. That's stimulus.
Yeah, it's so small. It's that spiraling upward thing that I talk about
right, occasionally.
Yeah, that's right. Seems like a good idea to me. But, you know, there's part of me that thinks maybe if we did more, giving more to the wealth class, maybe more to the Romneys of the world, maybe then something would trickle up. Because, you know, they kept telling me, trickle down, give them enough, something will fall out of the pocket, and then we could fight over the crumbs. I've just not seen any crumbs.
No. And, I mean, we've done this upward redistribution. We've had 30 years leading up to the Great Recession of policy changes that led to total upward redistribution, and it did not unleash growth. I think that's one of the things. All those policies we were talking about, they were sort of sold to us as, well, here's the thing.
Everyone knows
that if you let the real value of the minimum wage erode, it'll increase inequality. Everyone knows that if you let unionization decline, it'll increase inequality. Everyone knows you keep the unemployment rate high, it will increase inequality. Those kinds of policies were sold to us in the following way. They were sold to us as, all right, we know they're going to increase inequality, but listen, they are going to be so great for our economy because they're going to unleash growth. They're going to make us so much more agile, so much more productive, so much more flexible that it'll unleash growth. It will increase growth so much that even though it'll increase inequality, everyone will actually be better off. So that's how those things were sold to us. That's how this economic model that we've been operating under for the last 30 years was sold to us. But it didn't happen. We certainly got the increased inequality, but we did not get the commensurate burst in growth that was supposed to make everyone better off. So instead what we saw was, you know, massively increasing inequality, and the people at the middle and below flat or actually reductions in their standards of living.
So let me ask you, last question I've got for you, because, you know, my this whole cliff thing, I called it the fiscal mirage because it was made up, but this made-up crisis, would a good policy be, you know, if we're going to go through policy, they were arguing for just going back to the Clinton years. I was arguing for going back to the Eisenhower years. Would that be decent for what we're talking about?
Yeah,
inequality back together? Because we've got to do something to combat this inequality so we get money into folks' hands who are at the end of the scale, as you've pointed out, so that we can get that engine going again.
Yeah, I don't have the exact figures in my head, but if you look at people who try to look at optimal tax rates, especially for optimal corporate tax rates, optimal tax rates for people at the upper echelons, they're much, much, much higher than what we have, that we could actually tolerate tax rates that are, you know, like you said, not just getting back to Clinton years, but even much higher than that. So there's a lot of wiggle room where we could get more revenues out of increasing taxes at the top without hurting the economy, and then that money could be spent on other more productive things. So there is indeed a lot of wiggle room there. Politically, it's another question, but economically, it's absolutely, we could go a lot further.
So there are a lot of policy things we can do. It's not inevitable. The piece is Assessing the Job Polarization Explanation of Growing Wage Inequality, written by Heidi Shaneholtz, economist over at the Economic Policy Institute. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Heidi's name. Take you right to the piece. You can read through it. Heidi, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
You too. Thanks a lot.
All right, quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The official theme song of President Barack Obama's three-day inaugural ceremony and celebration should be Little Richard's classic, Slippin' and a-Slidin', Peepin' and a-Hidin'. A month ago, Obama himself put his inaugural committee on the slippery slope of ethical compromise by choosing to accept cash donations from corporations to pay for the festivities, which are estimated to cost in the neighborhood of $40 million. This decision went against his own principled stand just 4 years ago to reject money from these special interests. Acknowledging that his ethical backflip this year looks bad, he's trying to soften the impact by declaring that, one, his lawyers would get every corporate check to make sure it does not pose a conflict of interest, and two, that every donation would be promptly posted on the inaugural committee's website for all to see. But as he slid behind this pledge of transparency, he slipped on his own legalistic cleverness. Go to the website, www.2013pic.org, and sure enough, you'll find a long list of names. But that's it. No indication of whether they're corporate executives, no clue as to what city or state they're from, and no revelation of how much money they've chipped in. This isn't transparency, it's trickery. Only six corporate names appear, including AT&T, Microsoft, and Swiss-owned biotech giant Genentech. Excuse me, but all three of these have truckloads of favors they want from the White House. They reek of conflicts of interest. Again, there's no disclosure of how much cash each one put up. But news stories have revealed that the Obamacans are asking some donors for as much as $1 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, who do they think they're fooling, besides themselves? This isn't slick. It's clownishly inept. And it's ethically shameful.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Seems like things are kind of upside down. Choke a juice on water, turn around her little game. He's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane.
Tell you, ever since the sexual harassment claim against the Hermie there, that song brings on a whole new meaning for me. He's done it before, he'll do it again, coming on like a train. Yeah, you figure that out. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. As a share of U.S. GDP, wages have fallen from over 50%, the norm for most of the 20th century, to just 43% of GDP. Wages have gone down. The reality is, as you look at the top of the economic scale, where of the, this pie, what you've seen is the top 1%, mostly the corporate executives. They have seen their portion of that nearly double from 7.3% in 1979 to almost 13% in 2010. So again, the pie going to the very top. And the crumbs. They're taking the crumbs with them. Ron sent me an email during the break. He says, why am I the only one that ties wage stagnation to Nixon's lifting of wage and price controls? He points out that after the controls were lifted, prices started to rise, but corporations realized they didn't have to raise wages. They could instead stuff the increases brought in by the increases in productivity into their own pockets. So as you saw that decoupling, and he's right, I mean, right about that time, that's when you saw the break from the meritocracy that they love to tell us about. The harder you work, the more you produce, the more you're going to make. Well, right around that time, he's right. That decoupling happened, where productivity continued to go upward, and wages flattened right off and then began to decline. So you and I, we're the ones getting the screws in this. And the argument that is made, and I hear it often, that, you know, well, you know, it's because we have all this computer stuff, and we've mechanized. You know, I think back to some of the reading I did from the 50s, where they were actually talking about a 3 or 4 day work week, 24-hour work weeks, where they were saying, you know what, we're mechanizing, machines are doing all the work. How do we get working people to benefit from that? You don't hear any discussion about that whatsoever today. I don't think anybody would dare bring it up, the idea that we should be working less hours and be able to support a family on working less hours. Hockey players say, well, you need to work more. You need to work harder. Like the billionaire over in Australia, that Gina Reinhardt, who probably the hardest day work she ever did was coming through the birth canal. $30 billion. Wouldn't know a hard day's work if it slapped her. Saying, well, you know, those people socialize and drink and talk too much. They should work harder. And, oh, by the way, I'm against the minimum wage. Because in Africa, they work for $2. That's the worldview that the right is bringing us. Work as hard as you want. You're never going to get ahead. And we've got to be talking about policy. And Heidi's right. We need to be talking about policy on how you bring back that growing middle class and how you bring the bottom up. So you do have, as Krugman pointed out, a great compression again, where we're in the same ballpark. Right now, we're on different planets economically. And like I said, I brought up the John Edwards thing, the two Americas. You've got people living in their gated communities. And then everybody else, eventually. I'd like to see that conversation. You know, how do we talk about, how do we divide the pie up so that people can not only survive, but live. Just a thought. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at therickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits, BBS Benefit Solutions, can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
We live in an island of stars called the Milky Way, and many know that our Milky Way is a spiral galaxy.
In fact, it's a barred spiral galaxy, which means that our galaxy probably has just two major spiral arms, plus a central bar that astronomers are only now beginning to understand. But where within this vast and intricate spiral structure do our sun and its planets reside?
Our galaxy is about 100,000 light-years wide, and we're about 25,000 light-years from the center of the galaxy. It turns out we're not located in one of the Milky Way's two major spiral arms. Instead, we're located in a minor arm of the galaxy. Our local spiral arm is sometimes called Orion Arm.
Our local Orion Arm of the Milky Way is about 3,500 light-years across and is approximately 10,000 light-years long. Our Sun, the Earth, and all the other planets in our solar system reside within this Orion Arm. We're located close to the inner rim of this spiral arm, about halfway along its length.
The Orion Arm is named for the constellation Orion the Hunter, which is one of the most prominent constellations of Northern Hemisphere winter, or Southern Hemisphere summer. That's why we see so many bright objects within the constellation Orion, because when we look at it, we're looking at our own local spiral arm. We have a picture of this at earthsky.org. Search for the words Orion Arm. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Well, it looks like, you know, from the reports that I'm seeing, it looks like our GOP friends are indeed willing to, well, take us over the next cliff, the debt ceiling cliff, if you will. The coin, I guess, off the table. Personally, I would have left it on the table just as a kind of a, hey, I may use this. Same thing with the 14th Amendment. I may use this. In fact, Harry Reid thought it was a good idea, sent a letter saying, hey, we'll support you if you decide to do it. At some point, this has got, as Congress comes back today, this has got to get done. The bills have got to be paid. We cannot have another downgrade of our credit rating, which is why I've asked Pat Garofalo, economic policy editor over at thinkprogress.org, to talk to us about what's going on. Pat, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the coin, I guess, the trillion-dollar coin off the table.
Yep, Bitcoin is no more. So that's one less option, I guess, we have at the moment.
Because I was really looking for a really big coin, one with like a Mount Rushmore type picture on it, with, you know, with Bush and with Reagan and with Hoover right in the middle, right between them.
I was thinking they should just put John Boehner on it.
There you go. Or never mind. I'm not going to go there. But, you know, from the beginning, I thought the coin was just a, kind of a gag. There were actually people who were going, that's a serious idea. We should do it.
Well, it was an absurd solution to an absurd problem. I think it was Josh Barrow writing at Bloomberg who said what we should do is we should trade the absurd solution of the trillion-dollar coin for the absurd problem of the debt ceiling and say, hey, we'll get rid of both these things at the same time. But the fact that we have this thing in place where Congress can basically tell the president he's not allowed to borrow the money that Congress has told him to spend is just silly to begin with.
It is ludicrous. But for me, I look at the 14th Amendment and I say, you know, there's an avenue that, I mean, it's right there to me in black and white. You pay your bills.
Yeah, unfortunately, last time around, the administration said that was a no-go, so I don't think they're going to want to come all the way back to that one this time around.
But, you know, that was then. This is now. You're looking in the face of this Republican. I look at Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee, who's basically said, hey, bring it on. We're ready for it.
Yeah, I think the other interesting solution that is floating around is that the government could offer essentially scrip, kind of IOUs. Which would kind of be the same as printing the coin. They would just say, hey, here's some kind of money, but not money, federal IOUs that will maybe let them get around the debt ceiling. I'm not sure why that's considered a more legal option than the platinum coin, which had an obvious law behind it, but that seems to be the idea that's gained the most momentum at the moment should we actually get to a debt ceiling breach.
I honestly can't believe you just said that. That's how the most powerful country on earth is going to operate and pay its bills.
On monopoly money, yeah.
I mean, that just blows my mind that it would come to this. I mean, this is money that's already been allocated. It's basically been spent. We just have to pay our bills.
Right, and if you think about this, either way, Congress is basically forcing President Obama to break the law. Either we hit the debt ceiling and President Obama and the executive are forced to break the law by not spending money that Congress has said they have to legally spend, or President Obama has to break the law by saying, forget about the debt ceiling, we're just going to do it anyway. It's simply absurd part of the law. No other country has something like this, and we should just get rid of it altogether.
I'm right there with you. I mean, if you've the point to argue this is when you spent the money.
Exactly, and raising the debt ceiling gives the executive no more power to do anything the day after than they had the day before. Congress already has all the taxing and spending power. This is just letting the executive execute, hey, the orders of Congress.
No, I mean, we occasionally we have a former congressman, Bob Ney, who comes on and talks to us from the folks over at Talk Radio News Service, and he says, you know, when he was in Congress, this was a yawn vote. You went in, okay, you went and had lunch. It was a no-brainer. It was bipartisan. It was just, hey, we've spent the money. We have to do it. It is what it is. Next.
Right, and you can go back and find, when you go back and look during the Bush administration when they had to raise it all the time, members of Congress now saying, oh, when you run up debts, you pay debts. Of course we're going to raise it. And it always was just an opportunity for the minority to come in and carp about too much spending and try and make the other guys look bad. And even President Obama voted against it once, but it was understood that the minority would not weaponize it. They would not say, hey, we are not going to raise it unless we get X, Y, and Z. But that all changed in 2010.
Yeah, how much of this is just, you know, this still smarting over the 90s when the government shutdown happened?
I think that's some of it. And I honestly question how big the actual default caucus is in the House, how many of them are actually willing to go over versus how many are just willing to see if President Obama is going to cave.
And that's the big one, because, you know, you go back to I always think of Dick Cheney saying, you know, the Democrats will cave, that's what they do.
and there is some precedent for that, right? We saw the last debt ceiling deal. We saw in the fiscal cliff fiasco that President Obama moved the line for the tax bracket. He seems to be very serious about not moving this time. During his press conference today, he said we're not paying a ransom in exchange for not crashing the economy. So he seems to have learned his lesson. We'll see if that actually holds true to the whole lack of negotiation.
And we're not a deadbeat nation, that we pay our bills.
But, yeah, and like I said, I really question how many House Republicans really want to see what would happen on the far side. I think there is a not insignificant chunk, but I don't think it's near a majority.
Have you guys looked at, over at Think Progress, has anyone looked at what will happen? I mean, are there any models of the doom and catastrophe and all of the end of the world scenarios if we don't, if we do go over the so-called cliff, if you will, if we don't raise the debt ceiling?
Well, so no one can model the kind of financial market response because we've never been there before. There's really nothing to model. What we can model is you can look at days during the month and look at your cash flow. So you can look and say, hey, on February 19th, this much money is going to come in and this many bills are due, and you can see what the difference is. And there are days when you just won't be able to pay Social Security, or you'll be picking between Social Security and benefits. And can you imagine having Jack Lew, who will hopefully be confirmed by them, sitting in the Treasury Department and being like, okay, we stiffed Social Security recipients on Tuesday, so I guess we'll stiff veterans on Wednesday, and on Thursday we'll stiff government vendors, and on Friday maybe we'll come back to Social Security.
We could do it with dice. I like the idea of having a bill kitty.
And that's literally what happens. Treasury will just have to decide on a day-to-day basis what bills they pay and what bills they don't pay. And government computers aren't even really set up to do this sort of stuff. It'll be like Jack Lew and his undersecretary sitting around with a notepad and deciding which bills to pay.
Yeah, I mean, because can you stop this machine? I mean, I guess that's the other question. Is it possible to stop? I'm sure a lot of this stuff is automated. I mean, we spent a lot of time during the 90s automating to get rid of people. I'm sure a lot of this stuff is automatic.
Yeah, that's actually a huge technical problem. Were we actually to go through it, it's that the computers are wired to set up and send out all the transfers, tax rebates, Social Security payments. A lot of that stuff is automated, and so someone would have to put the brakes on that. And like I said, that system isn't really set up to deal with a Treasury Department that is picking and choosing and paying some things some days and not paying other things other days.
So at the end of this, how much could this cost us? I mean, you stop and think about all the man hours it's going to take to you know, maybe get ready for this to happen, or when it happens to work through this. I stop and think about all the wasted money that just the threat of this, because you've got to be, each of these agencies have got to be prepared and have contingency plans and all of this stuff. It seems like a huge waste of time and energy when we could be talking about real productive things like, oh, I don't know, building stuff like roads.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And if you look at in 2010, the last time we went through this tongue and dance, just from the House Republicans playing chicken, we are going to wind up paying $19 billion with a B in higher interest payments because interest rates spiked for those days when the Republicans were goofing around. That's $19 billion just from the threat of going through the debt ceiling. But who knows what the cost is going to be on if they actually decide to go through with it.
Yeah, what happened to we're going to take care of every taxpayer dollar?
Except when the taxpayer dollars help President Obama look good. Those taxpayer dollars don't count.
So where do you see this going in the coming days? How long do you they're going to take this right up to the cliff? I mean, are we going to see this be right to the final hour?
I would operate under that assumption until there is evidence to the contrary. It seems like every single one of these episodes needs to go until the 11:59 before the deadline. So I'm not expecting anything to change this time, but we'll have to see. Maybe Boehner gets rattled, maybe someone in the Republican caucus gets rattled, but as of right now, I would not expect a resolution until the last possible minute.
Yeah, I think about what the rest of the world must be thinking of how, you know, because you know, we're supposed to be the world leader. We're supposed to be this great nation. At least that's what we tell everyone. Yet it looks like dysfunction to me.
Yeah, well, the rest of the world isn't doing so well right now, and I think it's kind of ironic that the Republicans who are always hollering that Democrats want to turn us into Europe and turn us into social welfare states actually want to push through the sort of European austerity that we've seen on the other side of the Atlantic, and that has absolutely killed economic growth.
I mean, do they not see that, or is it just blind faith ideology?
I think it's the latter. Jerry Nadler actually gave a great interview with the Business Insider today. Jerry Nadler, who was the congressman from New York, who was talking the loudest about the trillion-dollar coin.
Yeah.
He actually said you don't often get to see an experiment run in real time, but we did stimulus here, and we have growth that's bad, but is actually growth. Europe did austerity, and you have countries with 27% unemployment. I'm not sure how much more evidence you need.
Yeah, but here, maybe because like our trickle-down economics, we didn't do it enough. We didn't give enough tax breaks. We didn't deregulate enough. We didn't go far enough. So maybe the austerity, not far enough. Maybe we need to go just a bit further.
And that's what the U.K. is doing. Cameron and the conservatives in the U.K. keep coming back and saying, okay, we'll tack on another year of austerity. And they are actually about to go, if the economic indicators are right, which I would guess they are, they're about to go into a triple-dip recession. I didn't even know a triple-dip recession was a thing before the last couple of weeks.
Wow. Sad stuff. Well, I hope that your predictions are not correct. I hope this doesn't take us to the end.
I hope so, too.
I hope just can't we get back to just doing things that are supposed to be done? I don't know. Pat, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Thank you. Likewise.
All right, Pat Garofalo, economic policy editor over at thinkprogress.org. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you have experienced any of the following symptoms, crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Andy emailed me during the break. He points out that in Thailand, the minimum wage was raised to about $14 here in the U.S., an increase increased 40%. Because they had a whole bunch of political unrest. So to ease that political unrest, they raised the minimum wage 40%. He points out in quarter three, the GDP beat estimates, increasing 1.2 over quarter two versus the consensus estimate gain of 0.9. Year over year, he says from quarter three, 2011, the GDP rose 3%, a little below the 3.1 consensus. But here's the thing. I mean, the reality is that, look, the more money you put into people's pockets, the more money they're going to spend. I mean, it's pretty simple. You have people with disposable income. They spend on things that they need, maybe even lottery tickets. And, you know, I go back to this lottery privatization scheme, which I think is a bad idea. But the bigger bad idea is funding senior programs with vices based on, well, based on, do people have disposable income? Do people have that kind of income to spend? And, you know, they point to the economic downturn of 2009. As the one of the reasons that they had to, well, you know, when times were tough, you know, our revenue went down a little bit. So we need to privatize so that there'll be this guarantee. And they keep throwing out these guarantees, and I'm telling you, I don't see a guarantee. I've seen a global corporation set up, a Delaware company. I don't know if it's a subdivision or what. They've set up another one, they claim, here in Pennsylvania as well. I don't know how this is going to work out. I don't know if they can at one point say, you know what, this just isn't working out. We're losing money on it. We're cutting out and we're running. I don't know. But it seems to me to be a bad idea. And a lot of this stuff just seems to me to be a bad idea. And in the end, what it's really talking about is how do we fund our vital services? How do we fund education? How do we fund health care for seniors and all the programs that they need? And how do we fund programs to help the poor and the infirm? How do we do that? How do we fund just general operations? How do we pay for our military? Would you stand for a military lottery? I mean, because I had one person say, well, we should have a military lottery because it would be patriotic to buy lottery tickets. It would be patriotic to gamble. So, you know, there's part of me says, okay, I'm in favor of that. Let's fund our education, let's fund healthcare, let's fund senior programs, let's fund all of that stuff. And then we'll gamble with the military budget. What do you think would come of that? I mean, and I look at the latest couple of things that have popped up. You look down in Louisiana where Bobby Jingle Jangle Jindal is proposing eliminating the income tax and the corporate taxes. And of course, they're going to go to a sales tax. Now you see also that you see North Carolina going to do the exact same thing. Going to cut corporate tax rates, going to cut taxes for income tax, and you're going to go to a consumption-based tax, which overwhelmingly harm the lower working class and the poor. I mean, everyone from the middle of the scale down, it's going to decimate them because their taxes are obviously going to go up. It doesn't take a genius to figure this out, that if you spend 100% of your income, you're being taxed on 100% of that income. But if you're spending a small percentage of that income because you have such a large income, obviously you're not being taxed. And then when you get to that top part, because there was just a story the other day that, you know, in New York City, the cigarette tax is only paid, I forget, you know, by like 40% of the people. And you know those are the people who can't go to Connecticut or can't go to New Jersey. Those are people who are stuck in town. So what you end up with is you end up with a class of citizen, our global class, if you will, the well-to-do, who then can go elsewhere for their consumption. And you go, oh, gee, I never thought of that. Like, yeah. Yeah, it's like guys I used to know who would go, we used to run down to Virginia when I was driving a truck for a living. So guys would run down to Virginia and back. And there would always be, hey, you know, can you go, when you go down there, can you pick me up a carton of cigarettes or two cartons of cigarettes? Why? taxes are lower. So a carton of cigarettes is considerably less than they would be in Pennsylvania or in New York, because you had the ability to. And that's one of the big arguments against these kind of targeted taxes like the cigarette tax. But for me, the consumption tax, especially when you're talking about the bottom of the economic scale, which means we're going to be raising they're going to be raising taxes on food and clothing and everything else. Who does that harm? And who does it benefit? And it benefits those folks who, well, they can afford to lobby. They can afford to contribute to campaigns. And like Pat was talking about earlier, I mean, you know, you look at this austerity that the Republicans are bringing here, and he's right. I mean, what Nadler said is spot on. You very rarely ever get to see something play out right before you that you're going to end up voting on. You know, this policy that you're going to see in real time. If I do this, what's going to happen? Most of the time, it's a guess. It's a gamble. You know, I don't know. One way or another, we're going to rely on experts to give us some testimony and make up some models. We're seeing what austerity is doing. We're seeing what's going on. And we've seen that what they've done over there has caused their economic engine to pretty much stall. Industrial output has dropped by the largest amount in 3 years. This just out. The unemployment rate in the Eurozone has hit a high of 11.8%. That's a record. Spain, near almost 27% of the folks unemployed. But here, you know, we don't see it that way. And in Europe, they're talking about, hey, we're going to keep to it. We're going to keep to the path. Because this is what the IMF has told me. And I liked, you know, Reuters had an article. According to one of the EU top economic officials, this guy named Olli Rehn, he's with the Economic and Monetary Affairs Commissioner. He says, you know, hey, you know, the patient, you know, patient is out of intensive care. Still might have some time before she can give a clean bill of health, but, you know, out of intensive care. And I'm going, wait a minute, you're about ready to go into a triple dip recession. I don't know. I think, like Pat said, I don't know if that's ever happened. They're going into a triple dip. I don't want to go to that doctor. Keep me away from that guy. Because the medicine that he's giving, I think it's going to cause more harm than good. And you look at the report we talked about not too long ago, where the IMF said, well, you know, we made a boo-boo. You know, we didn't really think that when you took a dollar out of the economy, you know, a buck and a half would come out. No, we thought it would be 50 cents. We thought when you pulled a dollar out of the economy, only 50 cents would come out instead of a dollar and 50 cents. And I guess, you know, I thought about that. Maybe they failed second grade math. Because when I asked my first grader, I said, you know, if I give you a dollar and a half and I give you a dollar, what do you have? He goes, $1.50. So I go, okay, so if you take a dollar out of the economy and then 50 cents out, what does that come up to? He goes, $1.50. So I'm not sure how you messed that up. I'm taking a dollar out of the economy. It's going to cost the economy 50 cents. I don't know how you figured out that, well, it's only going to cost us 50 cents. I'm not getting that. But the reality is, the more we pull out, the more of this austerity we push down people's throats, the worse it's going to get. Common sense. Maybe we should get some of it. Maybe they have that on sale. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, the RickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Also, I got this neat little Stitcher app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. As always, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you've got anything on the lottery, I'd really like to talk about that. Because I'm telling you, I'm never going to buy one. But I still think it's a bad idea. Quick break, back with hour three.
Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
What's it like to be a freshman in the House of Representatives? Wisconsin's Representative Mark Pocan has spent the last 2 weeks becoming acclimated to life in Washington, D.C. Pocan said one of the priorities of the new Congress should be getting beyond the debt ceiling issue for at least a year, instead of simply kicking the can down the road to be fought over again every 2 months. He said getting past that will help Congress start addressing important issues such as the tax code.
We are going to do a revision of the tax code, and I think that there's a lot of things that we can find agreement on by people from different perspectives just because they're kind of antiquated laws. But we can't if we can't get past some of this other stuff.
Pocan said one issue that could continue gridlock in the Congress is the efforts to make cuts to Social Security.
There's a number of us in Congress who, if you start talking about cuts to Social Security or Medicare, they're going to be non-starters. And it's not trying to do it from a partisan perspective. It's just it's a commitment to people who have paid into these programs and are entitled to the very basic existence that they get from those programs.
While serving in the Wisconsin legislature, Pocan had a reputation for his ability to reach across the aisle and find common ground. He said he's hoping to bring that to Washington.
I think what I've always done before is what I want to do here. You can disagree, but you can do it without being disagreeable. And I'm hoping that, you know, we can have something get done early this session.
He said he thinks the weakness of House Speaker John Boehner and the negative perception constituents have of Congress could actually work in favor of getting business done in the 113th Congress.
Whether it's Paul Krugman or any other major economist who, you know, has a more populist perspective, they're all saying the same thing. So the question is, can we convince Congress to in this current set of negotiations? But, you know, let's remember, we have the president, we have the Senate on the Democratic side. They have the House, but it's a much different margin, and seeing just what he went through in trying to get his Plan B done, he couldn't even get votes for his Plan B, maybe there are some opportunities that we can, you know, get some things done with our Democratic minority, but with also maybe some folks who really are very cognizant that Congress is so despised and we need to do something.
Pocan is a member of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which has the United States Postal Service under its purview. He said he's very aware of the facts behind the struggles of the Postal Service and hopes to use his position to address those problems.
It's the only federal agency that has to pre-fund retirement for 75 years. The post office would be a profitable entity if it wasn't for this unusual requirement.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
That's why I started giving these speeches. My job is not only commander-in-chief, but educator-in-chief. And I needed to say to the people, you bet it's tough.
Yes, Mr. No Child's Dime Left Behind. And you bring in this whole era of standardized tests, really, really extremely profitable standardized tests. And you look at George's brother, Neil, who started this company. I think it's called Ignite, which is one of these for-profit testing companies where, you know, 2 plus 2 is now proprietary because they put it on a piece of paper. And you, as a school district, are going to have to pay for it. And we've put a whole bunch of stuff on top of these tests. So it's no longer, hey, the test is going to cost you a bunch of money, but if kids don't do well on the test, that's going to cost you a boatload of money. And really the whole system to me appears to be rigged so that you fail anyway, so that they take money away. And there's a movement going on across the country of people who are saying, you know, enough of this. Enough of this getting my kid all worked up about these tests. Enough of this high-stakes testing. Which is why I'm glad to see out in Seattle, there's some teachers saying, you know what, we're just not going to do it. Which is why I've asked history teacher Jesse Hagopian to come talk to us about what his school is doing out in Seattle, Washington. Jesse, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show. And let me just say, go Bulldogs.
There you go. You know, I look at this and all of this high-stakes testing, I guess I don't see the point in it. When I was a kid, you had the end-of-the-year test, and that was part of your grade. But as I understand it, this stuff has nothing to do with your grade.
Yeah, this test, the measure of academic progress, or the MAP test, is just a horrible test from start to finish. All the standardized tests have problems built into them, but this test is particularly atrocious. From the beginning, it was brought to us by one of these testing companies that made $4 million off of a test that was not aligned to our curriculum. So, in fact, students taking a ninth grade math test on this MAP program are getting questions that aren't taught until 10th or 11th grade. And you might ask, why would the district spend $4 million on a test that's not aligned to your curriculum? And you'd find out that the former superintendent who adopted this test for the Seattle Public Schools actually sat on the board of the company that made the test. Wow. And so, you know, it's not us saying this test is a scandal. It's actually the state auditor found this to be a, quote, ethics violation. And so teachers at Garfield High School have had enough with this test. And from what we hear, it's one of the first cases ever of an entire school refusing to give a test they believe is bad for kids.
Which is why I think it's important. Now, you're not against all testing.
Well, you know, at Garfield High School, there's a range of opinion about standardized tests. Now, all of us are united in wanting good assessment. We all believe that the MAP test should be replaced with assessment that actually shows the things that we're doing in the classroom. None of us are against accountability or against showing student growth. Now, there's some of my colleagues that would favor replacing the MAP test with a better standardized test. But then there's many like myself who think that actually we have enough standardized tests, and what we need to move towards is a more holistic measure of student growth. So things like portfolios that are done in many countries around the world that have higher educational outcomes than us, things where you collect student data over time, and then it actually shows what you're doing in the classroom, and it shows the growth that they're making. And I think that would be a much more effective way.
Yeah, Jesse, that would mean that we would actually care that teachers what teachers were. We wouldn't be changing teachers into factory workers. Because it seems to me education in this country is moving in the direction of being a teacher is just like, you know, you stamp it out on a punch press. You know, just little things called children, opening up the little vessels.
That's right. And in fact, if you do a little digging into history, I'm a history teacher, you'll find out that standardized testing entered the public schools in the early 1900s as part of what was called the efficiency movement and also the eugenics movement, a very racist movement. And those were the two people that were trying to quantify and categorize and rank and sort people based on a very set of narrow skills. So they were trying to grasp the efficiency that was there in the factories onto the schools. And we want to reject that. And we think, you know, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan needs to stop listening to billionaire foundations that are pushing a factory model of education and start listening to teachers like at Garfield High School.
Well, how much of this, and this is purely an opinion piece, because, you know, I look at this as this is how they're setting up public education to be destroyed. So you see this system set up where if you don't make in this average yearly progress like it is here in Pennsylvania, and at some point it's going to be 100% of your students have to make this, which is never going to happen, so that they can then take money out of the school districts and move it to other things like charters or cyber charters or Lord knows whatever they come up with next. But to me, it's all about how quickly they can destroy the public monster.
I really think there's a lot of truth to that. I think there's been a concerted effort by business interests to privatize the public schools in the form of charters, take public money out of the schools, and once you do that, you see them start to wither, and then you say, see, they're not working, and then you move to privatize them. That's their model, but we have a totally different model of education, and that's one that really invests our money in education. You know, we have really big problems facing our country today. We have endless war. We have climate change that's threatening humanity. We have an economic crisis. And you can't solve any of those questions by marking answer choice D. You have to teach kids to think big. And we want to teach the whole child. We want to actually teach these kids critical thinking and problem-solving skills that can address the big problems that we face in the world today.
I guess the follow-up to that would be, do the people who make the decisions want that? I mean, do you really want educated, critical-thinking kids, the next generation, to look back and go, boy, you really screwed us, and we're going to hold you accountable?
Yeah, I mean, from my own personal perspective, I think that they oftentimes are downplaying critical thinking skills for that very reason. I mean, Texas, in fact, a Texas Republican Party passed something in their platform trying to outlaw critical thinking in the schools. It was finally an overt statement of what we've often suspected. But I do think that teaching to the test teaches a very narrow set of skills that won't help us solve the main problems that we're facing today. And I'm so proud of the teachers at Garfield who are risking quite a lot, putting it all on the line. But they're not doing it alone. You know, we got sent today, a school in Florida sent us pizza during lunch, and that raised everybody's spirits. You know, the Garfield PTA is in support of us, and the students are in support of us, and it's spreading to other schools now around Seattle. Ballard High School teachers, many of them have joined us, and we just found out today that many teachers at Orca K-8 are also joining us. And I think this is going to become a national movement in short order. As I check my inbox, and it's flooded with people from all over the country and even someone from Egypt getting in touch with us, I think this thing is going, this is just the beginning.
Well, I'm hoping
of a movement.
Well, I'm hoping that we're seeing not only this as part of the movement, but also, but a whole bunch of people saying, you know what? What they've shoved down our throats for the last 30 years has got to change, and we've got to get out in the streets. We've got to stand up and be accountable and say no more, whether it be on the education front, whether it be on the low-wage workforce front. A whole bunch of these things we've got to be pushing back on.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, tomorrow is Martin Luther King's birthday. And I think if we truly want to honor one of our great leaders, we should think about acting as he did and taking direct action. And in his famous words, a letter from a Birmingham jail, wait has almost always meant never. And I think we're being asked to wait and slow down by the Seattle School District and you know, let a process unfold, and we're saying we're not going to give another test that's bad for kids at our school, and we're ready to take that action. We're going to have a rally next Wednesday at the school district headquarters, and we're going to build this movement as big as we can.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that people in this area are listening because, you know, we had a guy on last week to talk about opting out of having your kids opt out of taking the test, especially here in Pennsylvania, these high-stakes tests. And, you know, I'm hoping folks will do that because, you know, we've given too much power to these big testing companies. We've given too much power to the consolidation of these all of this stuff. And at some point, we've got back local control and pull back and actually have some input into our school districts.
Well, you said it, and I think it's really going to take the power of parents, teachers, and students uniting for what's best for public education. Parents opting their kids out, students raising the issue and rallying, and teachers refusing to give it. And I think we can raise much bigger questions about testing and what education is for. And if you think about what a norm reference test is, these standardized tests are, they require that a certain number of kids fail the test and or do very poorly on it, right? If everyone did very well on the test, then it would be considered invalid and they recalibrate the test. And so these tests require kids to fail, and that's not why I got into the business of teaching. That's not why most people go to be a teacher, to have a certain number be required to not do well. And so I think the whole model of these standardized tests has that fundamental flaw. You know, we're not against accountability or showing growth, but we need better measures of growth,
right.
Measures that are tied directly to the things that we are teaching in the classroom. You know, the old science fair idea, it works because kids work on a project and they have to demonstrate what they've learned through that project, and that gives you a far better idea of what that student knows. Collecting, I'm a history teacher. I teach thesis writing. I collect the thesis statements they do at the beginning, middle, and end of the year, and you can see very clearly the progress that they've made in being able to form an argument and defend it with historical evidence. And, you know, that's not on the test, but yet that is, a far better measure of if my students are learning to write and make important arguments.
I'm right there with you on that. Let me ask you last line of questioning. You know, I had read somewhere that the tests that this high stakes test, what's the high stake? I've read that there's no impact on their grade, no impact on their class standing. So why take it?
Well, they say that it's meant to be a diagnostic to help you figure out what grade level they're at and help them progress in math or reading. But in fact, when it's not aligned to our curriculum, it can't do that. But the high stakes part of it is that it is tied to teachers' evaluation. So if scores don't rise, then it can trigger further evaluation, very stringent evaluations that could push teachers out of the classroom. And so the thing is, if you were to go to Garfield High School and interview students about the test, you'll find that many of them just click buttons, or they often just race each other to see who can get done first. Because, you know, for them, it's just kind of a game, especially the third time they're asked to take it in a year. And so, but for us, it ends up, negatively impacting our evaluation. And that just seems ludicrous to me that there would be systems set up like that.
Wow.
Especially with a test that is shrouded in so much controversy in terms of it being an ethics violation.
I can't imagine giving the kids that much power over their teacher. I mean, you've really handed it over to the kids, because let's say they don't like you, Jesse. You're a little bit too hard in the classroom. They're going to say, well,
you know, I don't blame them for trying to race through it, because when the questions they're being asked aren't even things that they've been taught, they think it's silly.
Yeah.
And they skip through it. Who I blame is a district that really needs to reevaluate its policy. You know, but I do have high hopes that our district can do the right thing, because we have a new superintendent, we have a new administration, and I think that this is really a moment where they could quite easily say, this test was an ethics violation, we're going to cut it loose, and we're going to start over, and we're going to start by talking to teachers and find out what they think is quality assessment.
Well, there's a novel concept. It might just work. It's never been tried before, so maybe we give it a try. Jesse, I wish you nothing but the best of luck, and I'd love to talk to you again as this moves down the road.
Anytime, man. Give me a call.
Thanks so much, Jesse.
Thanks. Take care.
Jesse Hagopian, history teacher out in Seattle. And I got to tell you, I like the idea. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Just a pep and dig it, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, cause I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Tap and dig it, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot of long and 80 short days for this miner to cool on down. This cap can dig it, Mr. Harley can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The official theme song of President Barack Obama's 3-day inaugural ceremony and celebration should be Little Richard's classic, Slippin' and a Slidin', Peepin' and a Hidin'. A month ago, Obama himself put his inaugural committee on the slippery slope of ethical compromise by choosing to accept cash donations from corporations to pay for the festivities, which are estimated to cost in the neighborhood of $40 million. This decision went against his own principled stand just 4 years ago to reject money from these special interests. Acknowledging that his ethical backflip this year looks bad, he's tried to soften the impact by declaring that, one, his lawyers would vet every corporate check to make sure it does not pose a conflict of interest, and two, that every donation would be promptly posted on the inaugural committee's website for all to see. But as he slid behind this pledge of transparency, he slipped on his own legalistic cleverness. Go to the website, www.2013pic.org, and sure enough, you'll find a long list of names. But that's it. No indication of whether they're corporate executives, no clue as to what city or state they're from, and no revelation of how much money they've chipped in. This isn't transparency, it's trickery. Only six corporate names appear, including AT&T, Microsoft, and Swiss-owned biotech giant Genentech. Excuse me, but all three of these have truckloads of favors they want from the White House. They reek of conflicts of interest. Again, there's no disclosure of how much cash each one put up. But news stories have revealed that the Obamacans are asking some donors for as much as $1 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, who do they think they're fooling, besides themselves? This isn't slick. It's clownishly inept. And it's ethically shameful. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Guess what? The majority of the American people believe we should have a gold standard, not a paper standard.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give me a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website again. Let's go to the phones. I got Jake on line one. How are we doing tonight, Jake?
Hey, good, Rick.
So you're at the big hearing today.
Yes, a long, long hearing. Four or five, the interested groups were there, including AFSCME. A couple of the secretary of the Corbett administration, the secretary of revenue, was there. I know you have a short time here, but I'd like to quickly go over some of the testimony and kind of point out at the end what the situation is and which senators did well in questioning. I'd like to get into that a little bit. I don't know what part of the meeting you were there, Rick, but the first to testify was Musser, who's the revenue secretary. Now, he claims, and here's where it kind of starts, according to the administration, that in 2011 there was a legislative directory to study the lottery. And according to him, according to that study, the state will have complete control and also in charge of the audits, which is what the situation is now. Now, according to the secretary, they guarantee $50 million the first year by this new company. They're going to put up front about $150 million, and I don't know if Dave went through this, but I'll kind of glance over this. It's important to know exactly what the parameters here. There's 1 year guarantee for contractual obligations for the employees. The 160 out of the 220 are union employees. The state gives, and this is key, according to Musser, the state law gives the secretary the right to manage. And that's a key point to the state's argument. The law gives the administration the right to privatize by giving the control of lottery revenues outside of slots. It guarantees a 3-year 30% increase. Oh, and by the way, the state doesn't call it a privatization. They like to refer to it as a public-private partnership. I thought that was kind of...
No, they didn't actually call it. They didn't call it a public-private partnership. If it were called that, I think it'd be a whole different animal. They're just calling this a service management contract.
Well, the testimony was, and you can check it, go back and check the records, they're saying it's not private. Their point is they're trying to soften the implication. They are calling it public-private. We can disagree with that. But,
no, because if you remember, Senator Pat Vance asked that question, and she actually said that, you know, and I wrote it down because she said, "Well, we're not gonna talk about technical things here," which I thought was quite interesting. We're not going to argue about technicality on P3s.
I believe you're pointing out some things that was prevalent. I think that the senators went out of their way not to be combative. And there are some issues, even the definition. I guarantee you there's a conflict of interest as to exactly how you want to describe this relationship that the state wants to create.
So what do you think of it? I mean, when you sat there through the testimony, through, you know, 5 hours of testimony, what at the end of that, we can go bit by bit. The reality is, what do you think of it?
A lot of questions unanswered. I know Dave Filmon did a good job of questioning exactly what's coming down the road. I mean, they keep making these promises. I mean, according to what Dave Filmon said, it's kind of vague as to how the union employees would be retained, or if they would be retained, if they would be management jobs, if they would be union jobs. And I got to tell you, the one senator who I thought really stood out was Senator Devlitz. He asked some really direct questions that went directly to the heart of it. You know, he was the one guy who had the kahunas to say, you know, this administration is being arrogant by not having meetings, by not being more transparent. He said it just shows the arrogance of this administration. He said, I have some real concerns about expansion of online sales and keynotes. He said, I believe that is a dangerous expansion.
Yeah,
he was one of the few that came out directly and questioned these people, and I was glad to see that.
What do you think about Wozniak's comment? This is what Wozniak had to say.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And under the in the Senate at that time, the up until the last election, it was 30-20. So the Republicans had even more of a majority. I think he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. I think the Republicans are being hypocritical, clearly. But I have to say this, my perception, and I'd like your reaction, Rick, I got the perception that there were several Republicans that were visibly upset. I mean, they tried to restrain their reactions, and they tried not to be combative, but I think they were upset as to what the governor was doing, even though obviously he's the same party. I believe they're upset. They should be. I mean, that this is a real smack in the face to representative democracy.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, I believe they can play the game. They can come out and do the dog and pony show. At the end of the day, they're on board because it's the ideology. It's the ideology of nothing can be held by you and me. Nothing can be held by we the people. Everything has got to be profitized and privatized and out of the hands of we the people. That's the ideology, pure and simple. And this whole thing to me stinks. Purely of ideology, nothing more. There seems, and you know, I've talked to Dr. Tom Wolf, who was the revenue secretary for a while, also a very prominent businessman, says, I see no point in this. I see nothing good in this.
Well, it's like Dave Wilman said, you know, it's the old adage, if it ain't broke, why do you want to fix it? And then you had this Camelot organization coming in, and if you listen to their testimony, Rick, you would think they're the best thing since sliced bread.
Well, of course they are.
And they throw some impressive numbers at you, but at the end of the day, I'm very skeptical that they can meet the increase in sales.
I think they can. I think they can meet the increase in revenue by screwing the people over, by selling a lie, by lowering the amount of prize money that goes out. I mean, they've already, Dave Filmon was on here, said 61% of the money now goes out in prizes. They said in testimony, the people from Camelot, in the UK, it's 50%. So immediately, you know that the first thing they're going to look at is dropping that 61 down to 50. And there's a whole bunch of other real technical stuff that goes into this that I'm just not comfortable with handing over.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you. And by the way, when you talk about states that of going to a privatized system. And I'm sure you know this. There's two states right now that are having trouble getting the money from the companies that have been contracted by the state. I believe it's Indiana and Illinois. So there's, you know, the privatization route, and it is privatization. It doesn't matter how they frame it. It's privatization of a process that the state not only had control but was very beneficial. And at the end of the day, if they don't do their job right, that's going to hurt senior citizens. And I thought the testimony by the man from AARP did a good job in pointing that out.
Well, I mean, wouldn't the question to be asked from the guy from AARP go, you know, what does it say about our society? What does it say about our culture that here in Pennsylvania, our lottery funds vital programs for seniors and for them? But in the UK, the lottery funds heritage and cultural programs, the Olympics, not vital programs like we're talking about here. So we've based, you know, seniors' ability to be okay, to be funded based on our vices.
Now, he pointed out another thing. He was a little concerned. He said, and this gets into the minutia of the whole deal. His concern was that the lottery in the last 5 years has shifted about $1 billion from the lottery to Medicaid. And then that gets into shortfall of funds from the federal government, what have you. So there's a lot of questions that remain unanswered. There's a lot of groups that have some real, real concerns. At the end of the day, where we go from this, Rick, is we're going to, you know, AFSCME's going to court.
Yeah, and, you know, I still think there's, I'm still hoping there's a way legislatively to stop this. Did they say anything about any future hearings? Did you hear anything? Because I haven't.
I haven't. I believe the only way that'll happen if the court either totally stops it or puts some restrictions on it.
Interesting.
That's the only way I see it happening, or the court orders that you have. But it's a little bit like closing the barn after the horse went out, isn't it? Like today. Now they covered themselves. If you listen to Secretary Musser, he said we really couldn't have these meetings and we really couldn't detail all this information prior to that because of the fact that we were negotiating with some of these companies who had put their bids in. And, by the way, I don't know if you heard the testimony. According to them, there were actually three companies that were interested. And according to what was said, two of the companies dropped out. One of the companies dropped out because they thought he was too sweet a deal for the senior citizens.
No, that's the appearance that they try and put out. That's the lipstick they're putting on this pig.
Well, sure it is.
Yeah.
Sure it is. Yeah. But, at the end of the day, AFSCME's going to rest their future on this case in court, and I'm with you. I'm hoping for the people of Pennsylvania, and more to the point, the seniors, for their benefit. I hope AFSCME wins this. And the truth is, the lottery has done a fantastic job. It's provided so many benefits for the senior citizens. It would be a disgrace and a shame.
It's done such a good job. We should sell it and let somebody else profit off of it.
Well,
that's what we should do.
And at the end of the day, it's ideology. You're absolutely right. And you know, somebody made a comment, and I tend to concur that this is classic Alec. You know, this comes from the great Pujas in the conservative movement, and this is exactly what they would do. I mean, this governor would want to make this state a right-to-work state. I think he sees he probably have some problem in doing that. And he might even have reservations about whether he can get elected. So I think what he wants to do at this time, he wants to strike while the iron's hot. And unfortunately, the lottery is his target.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I appreciate the input on it, though, Jake. Thanks so much.
All right. See ya.
Quick break right back after this with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you've experienced any of the following symptoms, crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Well, they say that, you know, the ground under us might freeze over. If Clarence Thomas had anything to say, well, today he had broken a 7-year silence on the bench. 7 years. Now, think about this for a second. One of our Supreme Court justices, 7 years without asking a question of any of the attorneys standing before them. Nothing. And today, I wouldn't say it was so much of a question as it was kind of a mock against his alma mater. So it is what it is. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C. I got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
So what do you think of the big statement there by Clarence Thomas? Actually said something. They didn't have to poke him to see if he was alive today.
It was kind of like Gombo's feet.
Wow. You know, I often joke that, you know, why bother having him show up at all?
Well, apparently he's very active, animated, involved in chambers.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not even going there. I'm just going to let that go. Going to move right on. I understand we're not a deadbeat nation.
We are not a deadbeat nation. That's what President Obama said during the press conference that he held today on that topic. He said we are not.
His last press conference of his first term, tomorrow, next week, obviously the first of the next, but the last press conference.
It's the last press conference of his first term, but it's not the last press conference of his second term. We haven't even had the first press conference of his second term yet.
So does this, the we're not a debtor thing, this, a deadbeat thing, does this mean he's going to actually do something if the Republicans do, as I've been hearing a lot of voices saying they should do, and, you know, let them default, let the government shut down? I know Harry Reid sent a letter out saying, hey, use that 14th Amendment thing.
They're not going to use the 14th Amendment. They're not going to use the Trinidad and Tobago. They're not going to use any of those things. What they're going to do is they're going to use bluff, bluster and just hardcore tactics. That's what they're going to do. They're not going to use... He said there is no magic. There are no magic tricks. That was his phrase. There are no magic tricks.
Okay, so no... I was really... You know, I kind of like the coin idea.
You wanted one. You wanted a magic trick.
I did. I wanted a big coin, a really big one, about the size of Mount Rushmore, so we could put Reagan's face on it and of course, W's face on it, right there with Herbert Hoover in the middle.
Not going to happen. No. There is no coin. There's going to be no 14th Amendment. No, nothing. And it was very interesting, you know, this deadbeat nation thing, this actually came in response. Newsweek Daily Beast, Michael Tomasky pointed this out. This is actually a response to a letter that Marco Rubio wrote to him a few weeks ago in which he accused him basically of being feckless and allowing us to become a deadbeat nation. This was a letter that nobody noticed. So he's turned it around and made the phrase his own and turned it into "We are not a deadbeat nation." Nobody knows that Marco Rubio used it first.
Well, they do now.
They do now, but it doesn't really matter because it turnabout's fair play.
But at the end of the day, I mean, really, honestly, and truthfully, are the Republicans willing to go to the mat, I mean, all the way to the end of this? Because I know during the 90s, they, you know, they're still smarting from the last time they got their hats handed to them over this. Are they really looking for part two, and are they really willing... from people that you've talked to, are they really willing to let all of the negatives that the economists are saying could happen, are they willing to allow that to happen?
Yes. Huh? I think that there are members of the Republican caucus in the House who are absolutely prepared for the full faith and credit of the United States, as some call it. I don't think they'd even call it that. That they don't even believe that you have to default if you reach the debt limit. But they are prepared for that to happen if it has to happen. They're absolutely prepared for that to happen. They're also prepared to shut down the government.
And they think they're this is a good thing. So granting not getting a check and you know, who knows what else. The FBI shutting down, the CIA, all that stuff shutting down, everything coming to a halt.
Well, Pat Toomey wants to write a bill. I think it's Pat Toomey wants to write a bill that would prioritize what order all the different checks get sent out in.
Okay.
But it's not really like that. That's not the way the computers work.
But it's a nice talking point.
Yes.
And because it goes to that kitchen table frame. That, you know, this month I only have so much money, so I'm going to have to pry. I had a buddy who used to have a bill kitty. He would assign each one of his bills a number, and he would roll dice to decide which one got paid. Maybe we could have a bill kitty for the U.S. government. What do you think?
That is a plan. I think you just nailed it.
We could, but we would need an awful lot of dice, I think.
Yes,
To decide which bill you're going to
pay. We're an innovative nation. We can do that.
Or I know what we could do. We could give that contract of what gets paid to Camelot, you know, the people who run the UK's lottery that now are going to run the Pennsylvania lottery, they could figure it out since evidently our Republican friends in Congress are struggling to do that.
Well.
I think I'm going to go with this Bill Kitty idea. I like this.
I think you should go with it.
Go with it. But then again, my friend had a horrible gambling problem, and he would gamble most of his money away before he got to the bill kitty, and there was usually nothing left. But that's a whole nother story. I think I'm going with the bill kitty thing.
I like the bill kitty thing.
So the folks in New York then, if I get this right, you know, there's no point in talking about a bill for the victims of Hurricane Sandy then, because if we're not going to pay the bills we've already got, we can't obviously make new ones, right?
You know, nobody's actually saying that.
Okay.
What you've just said, nobody's actually saying that. Everybody's going forward and going through the motions of adding these 100 amendments, this Christmas tree of amendments to the Sandy bill, which will get knocked back, so there'll probably be about 15 amendments, which is probably still enough for a poison pill, possibly, on the Sandy bill. The House Rules Committee is designing that tonight. And they're all going forward like it's actually going to happen and like we're not going to default.
I mean, if the end of the world is imminent, why bother? Why go through the song and dance Why bother? Why not just tomorrow, as I understand they plan on doing, just read all day. Let's have a reading day.
They are!
Yes, let's just have a reading day.
That's exactly right. You nailed it. That's precisely what they should do. They're going to do that thing. They are going to settle down, get comfy, get blankies, and read the U.S. Constitution out loud.
And like when my kids were 2 and 3 years old and they had their favorite blankies, they would suck their thumb. So, that is a perfect image then. They're going to curl up with a good blanket, a book. You know, the kids always like the pop-up books, lots of pictures. Take us back to the Bush years, if you will. And, you know, suck their thumbs. And I'm thinking I'm liking this.
That's what they're going to do. The idea is that this is important because, and it's interesting, Representative Bob Goodlatte came up with this, Republican of Virginia. One of the things that he said about it in a statement Monday is, this reading of the Constitution demonstrates that House Republicans are committed to our Constitution and the enduring principles for which it stands. I'm not sure where that leaves House Democrats.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. But maybe, do you think they'll read the 14th Amendment?
I'm not sure whether they will. But controversy arose when they did this 2 years ago by Representative Jesse Jackson, who objected to reading the Constitution as amended. In other words, meaning portions of the document that had since been superseded by amendments, such as the 3/5 clause.
Ah, okay.
He objected to that. That would be left out. He thought we should keep the 3/5 clause in.
No, I'm with him on that.
He was overridden.
We should read. In fact, you know, we've got so much time, evidently, and there's nothing else that needs to be done. I mean, we don't have to worry about our infrastructure is state of the art. Our education system, voila, just the best in the world. There's nothing we could possibly do better. We've got so much time to do nothing. Why don't we read all of them? In fact, you know, throw in some children's book, Moby Dick, maybe, you know, War and Peace. War and Peace, you know, probably.
War and Peace, that's the one.
I'm with you. We should just read.
They should read War and Peace to get in some practice just in case they do filibuster reform.
There you go. And not the phone book.
No.
You know, I love when they come back to town. And today, I guess, day one back for the whole debacle thing?
Yep. Today one's the first day back for the debacle. They're back with the debacle, and tomorrow they're going to be doing Sandy debacling and Constitution debacling, and then they've got one more debacling, and then they're off again.
Yeah.
They've had enough. They're only in for 3 days this week, then they go off to a retreat for the rest of the week.
Oh, boy. I wish to be a fly on the wall there as they're banging drums and doing whatever it is the hell they do.
I know. Wouldn't that be great?
No, depends. I think I had a really bad weekend. I would probably strangle somebody. Yeah,
I don't think your wife would want you to go.
Yeah, probably not. So I guess Tuesday is tomorrow, the big proposal on the guns thing from Biden coming out, right?
Well, we assume so. Now, he's already given the proposals to the president, who is considering them, and he and Biden had a meeting about them at some point today. So I don't know whether the actual proposals will be released to us or whether we'll wait to hear just what, whether we'll hear the proposals or whether we'll now just hear what it is that the president's going to do, whether we'll never hear actually what the actual proposals are. It's not clear to me what we're going to hear next.
Mm.
But we are going to hear something from the president this week.
Good, because, you know, I'm tired of getting all the emails from the right-wing gun nuts telling me, Obama's going to take your gun, and to go out and buy as many as you can now while you still can. And I'm going, it's just not going to happen. It's just not.
It's not going to happen, and as Obama said in his press conference when he was asked about the lines of people, you know, lining up to buy guns, he did say that this was being ginned up by the gun industry, you know, to make money.
Yeah, well, you know, and I don't know. You look at this and you go, at some point, do we have to not have some rational thought enter our head? Maybe not.
Why now?
And finally, did you see the big Golden Globes?
I saw as much as I could before I had to go to Betty Bye, but I did. I saw quite a bit, and I saw Zero Dark Thirty yesterday. So long ago. I've seen Zero Dark Thirty, so I was very pleased that Jessica Chastain won.
Good. Yeah. Did you like the Zero Dark Thirty movie?
Yeah. It's a gripping. It's an intelligence procedural, kind of like a police procedural, but about intelligence.
Well, maybe I'll have to take a look at it.
It's a good film.
Yeah. I've never watched the Golden Globes. I honestly don't even know what they're for. I know it's an actor thing, and they give out awards to each other. But someone had sent me the Jodie Foster thing.
Yes.
And asked me, did you know she was gay? And I'm going, well, like, for 20 years, I think everybody thought that, and who cares?
Yeah, I know.
But I thought she gave I got to be honest, that her speech, you know, almost brought tears to my eyes, especially when she talked about her mother.
It was very moving.
It was touching. And she's right. Leave the people alone. Give them some privacy. Mind
she's
your own business.
She's a very private person. This is a big deal for her.
Yeah, mind your own business.
No, exactly.
And, you know, and we used to. I mean, my grandfather used to always say, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. And that was kind of that generation. You know, worry about yourself. We'll take care of our stuff. You take care of your stuff. You leave us alone. I'm okay with that.
I'm okay with that, too.
Yeah, and I would be okay if we didn't have to ever see the Golden Globes again.
No, I wouldn't, because I want to see the dresses.
Well, on that note, we can leave it there. Victoria, always great talking with you.
You too. Bye.
Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We live in an island of stars called the Milky Way, and many know that our Milky Way is a spiral galaxy.
In fact, it's a barred spiral galaxy, which means that our galaxy probably has just two major spiral arms, plus a central bar that astronomers are only now beginning to understand. But where within this vast and intricate spiral structure do our sun and its planets reside?
Our galaxy is about 100,000 light-years wide, and we're about 25,000 light-years from the center of the galaxy. It turns out we're not located in one of the Milky Way's two major spiral arms. Instead, we're located in a minor arm of the galaxy. Our local spiral arm is sometimes called Orion Arm.
Our local Orion Arm of the Milky Way is about 3,500 light-years across and is approximately 10,000 light-years long. Our Sun, the Earth, and all the other planets in our solar system reside within this Orion Arm. We're located close to the inner rim of this spiral arm, about halfway along its length.
The Orion Arm is named for the constellation Orion the Hunter, which is one of the most prominent constellations of Northern Hemisphere winter, or Southern Hemisphere summer. That's why we see so many bright objects within the constellation Orion, because when we look at it, we're looking at our own local spiral arm. We have a picture of this at earthsky.org. Search for the words Orion Arm. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
In the end, Wall Street with Obama, Duncan, Bloomberg, Walcott, and Goldstein as its agents, they once turned public education into private profitable businesses. They hope to impose factory regimes of managerial control over educators' working conditions and our students, our children's learning conditions.
Well, you know, I got to be honest, I'm happy to see that finally you're starting to see some pushback. I mean, when did No Child's Dime, when did that get passed? When did No Child's Dime Left Behind get passed? Early during the Bush years. It was 2001, I think it was. Big major achievement was against it. This whole privatization, the whole... And again, I go back to when I was in school, and maybe it's just because I'm getting a little older. I remember them photocopying tests. And I guess that's the thing that threw me right from the beginning, this idea that 2 plus 2 is now proprietary information and it has to be purchased from somebody. I like the idea of having a professional teacher, not just someone who facilitates, not just someone who hears. I've seen that in action. I don't like it. I don't think it works. And I look at these tests and all of the money that we've spent on it. And what's it really gotten us? Which is why I'm glad to see that finally there's some folks saying enough already. Because I think it's about time. It's enough already. When you start seeing the big players, when you start seeing the Mike Bloombergs of the world and the Buffetts and the big money going, man, that's a good investment. Good, sound business investment. That makes me a little leery. Just a thought. And I look at, you know, what we've done to educational funding. There are states who fund, like Ohio, for instance, funds their education with the lottery. Here we're funding senior programs. I don't know. I guess it's a very different worldview. And I look at, you know, you got these competing ideologies. You look at in California, for instance, where they went to the taxpayers and say, we need to increase our revenue. And they're going to do that. Revenue's been up. Actually, what you're seeing is the economy turning around. You're seeing a surplus for the 2014 budget period. That's what they're hoping for. Yet in New Jersey, and this is one of those things that kind of makes me pause. Tomorrow, I guess they're going to talk about the Sandy money, right? Which at this point, I go, why? If you're not going to pay the bills you made yesterday, why you make new ones? But that's a whole other argument. Chris Christie in New Jersey is, for all indications, he's pledged to cut taxes. He's going to continue to go and try and cut taxes at a time when their revenues have fallen short. So at a time when you're going to need more money to make sure that you're able to meet the needs of your citizens, and for all the song and dance and all of the, you know, the outrage about, oh, I didn't get my money, it's amazing to me how at the end of it, Chris Christie still pledged to the wealth class. And the tax plan that he came out with in 2012 would have given 40% of the benefits to the richest 1%. And for folks like you and me in the middle, they're looking at like $80. And you go, explain that. Explain the rationale behind it. Explain how it is that your state's struggling. I mean, you've been massively hit. You're going to need every dime of resource, every bit of resource that you have to rebuild. Yet what you choose to do is give a huge tax break that will then be moved out somewhere else possibly. And then target it to a very small number of people. Doesn't that seem odd to you? I mean, doesn't it seem just plain wrong? And then to turn to the federal government, and look, you know, he did a great job getting media attention, did a great job pointing the fingers, and then turned to the feds and said, you're not giving me enough money? On one face of it, it's hypocritical. On another face of it, it's theft, in my view. I mean, it's like, okay, we're going to give away our own resources so we can take from here. Isn't it everything that they say that they're not in favor of? Because our revenues obviously have not kept up. You know, when your big tourist areas, when your big casino areas are basically wiped out, you're not bringing in the money. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com, Stitcher on your smartphone. We'll see you tomorrow.
Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous.